The following podcast of the STR radio program is made possible through the generous support of our listeners. You can support this podcast by going to str.org and making a donation today.
This is the show your pastor warned you about.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the show. Greg Kokel here, and I also have to say Happy New Year, because it is it is the new year. Whether it's going to be happy or not, I guess we'll know over the next few months for you, but I wish you the best from Stand to Reason. I'm glad you're with me today. Our first show of this new year, 2013. Glad to be with you, and had a little break last weekend for the holidays, and now we're back in the saddle again. And it's I'm celebrating the new year here with long underwear. I'm starting it. I am actually wearing it now because it's cold. It got to freezing over the holiday, and I looked at the, checked my iPhone to see the weather report for the next couple of days, and we're going to be down in the 30s. It's hardly been a day. I've gotten up out of bed and walked over to the thermometer in the house to turn the heater on because we don't have it on at night. We're all under the covers, right? And it hasn't been right hovering around 60 degrees. That's in the house. That means it's like 40 degrees or 30-something on the outside, but... So it's nice to snuggle up in these warm things, and it's nice to be back talking with you here on the show. 1-800-227-5278 is my number, and people are getting in the queue already. I'll be glad to chat with you about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. Of course, my goal is to advance and to contend for the Christian view of reality, that is, the Christian view of the world or the Christian worldview. And I use those terms because I mean to argue that what Christianity holds to be so actually is so. In other words, the world is the way Christianity and Jesus of Nazareth characterized it. The biblical worldview is the correct worldview. Of course, many people disagree with that, and that's why we have a show, because people will either take exception with me, and they do that on the air, and that's fine, and they give me a piece of their mind, I give them a piece of mine. That's the rules here. But also I have followers of Christ who share my convictions, calling in, saying, help me out with someone I'm dealing with, or some issue I've confronted, or something I don't understand, and that's what we do here too. And we are just at the close here, these next weeks, of my 23rd year doing this. I think in February we start 24 years of radio. Well, that's a lot. And so bringing that experience and dealing with all those issues here to the table to do my best to help you out on the things you're dealing with. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. If you're in the 714 area code, that's local to me. That number is 754-4150. Just dial it up. And as we're rolling here, just wanted to let you know that I got a chance to see a couple of movies with my wife. We had some movie dates this last week, and I had a number of things on my schedule. Didn't get to all of them. Only it didn't get to Lincoln, for example, and that's coming up soon for us, hopefully. Didn't get to The Hobbit yet, and I understand that if you see it in 3D at like the 45 frames per second or whatever that high density stuff is, that's like standing right there in Middle Earth while it's happening. So we'll see. You know, I'm kind of an old-fashioned guy. I'm not hot on the glasses stuff. I did it once for the Alien movie with the blue creatures, whatever that was. Avatar, but haven't done it since. Well, we'll see what happens. Maybe you have a suggestion for me. And those of you who've seen it in that really high density 3D, apparently there's two different densities, and one's like 30, whatever it is, FPS, frames per second. Another one's 45, really dense. If any of you have a recommendation, well, I'd be here, glad to hear about it. But we did get to see two films, and the first one that we planned to see was Jack Reacher, and it was one of those days. This is the new Tom Cruise film where he's a cop, kind of a whodunit, shoot him up kind of thing. And, you know, sometimes you just, I don't know about you guys, but for me and my wife, we just want to get out and get away and watch the bad guys get what's coming to them, all right? And we didn't expect a lot of, you know, deep theology or deep philosophizing or anything. We didn't even expect a very complex plot with the Tom Cruise movie. We just wanted to see some action and get lost in it. Now, as it turned out, that first night we didn't see Jack Reacher because when we got to the theater, this was our local theater. I mean, not too far from us. We've got a number of them in our community, but this is one where we kind of slip over to. It's been around for a long time. You slip in quickly at a bargain rate. You get pretty much up-to-date movies. You get in and you watch your movie. You get home. You know, it's simple. It's in and out. It's close by. Well, when I got there to buy the tickets, well, things had changed a little bit. And I hadn't been here to that show for a while. And I noticed the counters were different. And I wasn't looking around so much. We were a little bit late. I wanted to get in. And so the lady asked, well, what seat do you want? And here are the seats. Well, I don't want to choose a seat. And I don't know what it is with this new deal, what the premium theaters now, you pick your seat. I just want to walk in and sit down. But you pay extra for that, you know. And I had not had that experience with this theater. So I'm not thinking about it too much. I said, oh, all right, we'll sit there. And we looked at the legend, picked a couple of seats. And she said, that'll be $39.50, please. I went, $39.50? For two of us? Oh, didn't you get the old guy's discount in there? Yeah, that's including the old guy's discount for me. And I said, I am not paying $40 for a movie. And I looked around and I realized what had happened, that they'd overhauled this whole theater. And now it's one of those premium sites with the fancy seats, which, who cares if the seats are like passably comfortable? Who's thinking about the seats when you're lost in a good movie? So I don't care about that kind of stuff. I don't care about having assigned seats. That's just a pain, actually. And then you pay extra for all of that. And I looked around, and there they've got a little bar, a little restaurant in the foyer, and it was a totally different experience. My wife and I walked out. Now, in my pocket, I had some other local times for other movies. I knew we could go down the road a little bit and catch another one. It was Les Mis. And so we left Jack Reacher for another time, and we went and saw to see Les Mis. Now, I know that Les Mis has been done recently, within 4 or 5 years ago, as a regular movie, and I thought this was just another movie. I was a little surprised when I got there, and in the very first scene, people are singing. And I was especially surprised when one of the people, or the person singing, actually, in that opening scene was Hugh Jackman. You know, he's the guy with the swords in his fingernails, the wolf, not wolf man, but something like that. And all those other action films that he made, I was a little surprised. Now, he's got apparently quite an impressive record on Broadway, and he was completely up to the task. But I was caught a little surprised by this. I knew very generally what the movie was about, but I'd never actually seen a full production of it. We have the film version done a number of years before, but I never watched it. It's a DVD my wife picked up, and I'll watch it on an airplane sometime. I've got it in my bag for that purpose. So we got there, and the place was pretty full, which surprised me, although this was the holiday. And so we ended up having to sit right down front. We were probably three or four, maybe four rows back from the screen. And that was a little close. And here was this musical, and I wasn't geared up for singing, especially not Hugh Jackman singing. And then we got into the film, And I have got to tell you that it was one of the most impressive film experiences I've had in a long time. Not only was this a magnificent story, Victor Hugo, 900 pages plus in the original, if it's done properly, which it has been done a number of times in film, then you're going to get the power of this story. The story about law and grace and mercy and forgiveness and the like. But it was, because it was a musical done the very particular way that it was done, there was an emotional element to it. There was an opportunity to connect emotionally with the characters that you would not have had, I think, had there not been this musical element. Music gives a certain access to the heart, to the emotions, that allows you to experience a level of pathos that is very hard to accomplish from simply a well-acted film. By the way, this film was also superbly acted. And as far as I know, none of the major players were vocalist types. They didn't have people that were accomplished vocalists doing the main roles. Hugh Jackman, I mean, he's capable. Russell Crowe as Javert, the alter ego, if you will. Not alter ego, he's the opponent, in a sense, the opposite of the Hugh Jackman character, Jean Valjean. And who knew that Russell Crowe could sing, for goodness sake? Oh, he doesn't sing that well, but he's the bad guy, so he doesn't have to sound really nice. I thought he did fine, personally. And Anne Hathaway, I didn't know she could sing. But I have to tell you, the signature piece of this film was her presentation. I think it's called I Had a Dream. I Dreamed a Dream. Thank you, Melinda. And I was disassembled by this performance. Now, after we saw this, I went on the internet and was watching some of the interviews that you can see of the players that as they reflect on their roles. And Anne Hathaway made the point that, you know, we didn't think it would be honest to the characters and to the material to make this film look pretty. I mean, you think about the musicals that you might have seen in the past, and a lot of them are on the frivolous side. I don't mean frivolous like empty, but they're lighthearted. Think of Music Man. I mean, this takes you way back. What was the other musical we saw recently? Vegas? Was that a musical that was done not too long ago? Some major players. And I mean, it was a big production. It was popular about 4 or 5 years ago. Maybe I got the title wrong, but you guys know, I think you might know which one I'm talking about. In any event, this wasn't frivolous. This was a story about redemption set in a tragic set of circumstances just prior to the French Revolution. And it was the tragedy of the lives of these people that gave substance to the redemptive elements that came through the character of Jean Valjean, who was the prisoner who served his 19 years in prison and hard labor for stealing a loaf of bread to feed the starving children of his sister. And for that crime was put in prison for almost 2 decades. And then when he finally was let out, he broke parole and then became a fugitive. And the story then develops from a redemptive scene. I'm not going to give it all away, in very beginning after he decides to break, when he's on parole and he had been released, and something that changes his life where he experiences grace in a powerful way. And then he is in contrast to Javert, the Russell Crowe character, who's hounding him for the next 20 years, trying to capture him to make sure that the law gets its pound of flesh, because Jean Valjean broke parole. And it's more than a pound of flesh, according to their legal system. And so that's the drama in following this and the transformed life of the Hugh Jackman character in contrast to the Russell Crowe character, the grace versus law theme. And it's powerful. And it is, and in one of its most powerful moments, though, is in the life of Fantine, the female character who actually has a relatively short role because she doesn't live that long. And this played by Anne Hathaway, and in the depths of her despair, she sings this song, I Dreamed a Dream. And after I had come home, I'm still, after watching it, I was still a little unsettled. Like, this wasn't the movie I came to see, and it took me a while to kind of get used to this. But after I left the movie, I couldn't get it out of my mind. I couldn't get the song out of my head. I couldn't get the circumstances out of my thinking. And I continue to reflect on these movies. The Enforcer saw it a couple days later and had the same experience, she said. And actually, she wrote a piece about it January 4th in the Standard Reason blog. You can catch it there, a couple of paragraphs. And somebody mentions at the end, be aware that a scene involving the debasing of a prostitute is fairly graphic, which it is. There's no, like, exposure stuff. But, you know, it may make some of you uncomfortable. And there's no actual nudity there, but there's also some despicable characters in it. So there's a warning there for this, for those who might want to think about it. I had thought, after I was possessed more with this film in the aftermath, reflecting on it, I thought, you know, maybe Annabeth, who just turned 8, would be able to connect with the pathos and the details of the movie. I mean, I thought for a fleeting moment that might be the case, but I also thought when she was 7, she would enjoy Italy. And I brought her with me, but it had its moments, but it was hard for her because it was a foreign environment and food didn't taste like the pizza, for example, that she was used to and all of that. So what I realized, though, is that there are some experiences in life that it just takes a person being older to be able to appreciate. Maybe Rome is one of them, the case of a 7-year-old at that point. And also I think this movie, so though I thought it would be nice to take her and experience it with her, I realized that much of it would be lost on her. What resonated with me, listening to this powerful presentation of Anne Hathaway of Fantine and singing this song, was the, I mentioned pathos earlier, the tragedy of her life, the broken dreams, the lost confidence in God. One line in there is, I dreamed that God would be forgiving. And apparently she didn't think he was at that moment. Now, she had mentioned she thought it would, the actress, that this would not be right to make this movie sound pretty and the songs to sound pretty because of the tragic circumstances which were conveyed so powerfully by the original author, Victor Hugo. And so instead of giving a Broadway performance, Hathaway and Jackman and the rest of the performers acted out the parts. They lived the parts with music on their lips. They lived the lines musically, which means you don't get a pretty picture. You get a gritty picture. And it is the grittiness of it that, for me at least, made it magnificent, allowed me to connect with it. Now, I mentioned I was in the third row, so our fourth row, we were close to the screen. But not only that, the filmmakers did most of these kinds of scenes with extreme close-ups. And I saw some of the camera stills and the production pictures. You can get them on the internet. And there are the cameras right dead in the face of these magnificent performers who are pouring their hearts out in song and weeping and agonizing over the issues they're dealing with, right inches from the camera. You are right there with them. So I could say more about this. The theological things, if it's fair to call it that, and I'm pausing from calling it theological because on the one hand it is theological, and it's intended to be theological by Hugo, I'm sure. And though I'm not sure in the modern remaking of it, all the players get it, not the theological elements. But I hesitate from using the term theological because it doesn't feel theological there. What you get is a powerful cinematic characterization of the grace of God over and against the ugliness and the demanding taskmaster of the law. And, of course, this is personified in the Javert character, for him, the law is God. And he is so committed to the law that he is virtually incapable of mercy, yet he's still a human being. And when Javert's humanity simply will not allow him to carry out his deep convictions regarding the law, he is in such a conflict that he takes his own life. Very powerful towards the end of the movie. Maybe that's a spoiler for some, but it's a well-known story. The law requires us to fulfill a burden, carry a burden that we cannot carry. And this is, the law kills and the Spirit gives life. That's the theological lesson to be taken away. I hope you get to see the film. Be prepared for a gritty, real, powerful, emotional story. I will say this, and I didn't talk to you about this. That was right. It was Chicago. That was the other musical I was referring to, not Las Vegas, Chicago. But I did not like the last, 90 seconds of the movie. I mean, it was kind of their depiction of heaven, and it was D-U-M-B, all right? They could have done without that. It was worse than dumb. In any event, just ignore the last 90 seconds. The rest of the film is truly worth it. And maybe next break, next hour, I'll tell you a little bit about Jack Reacher. Or maybe I'll just say this. This is all it has to be. I really enjoyed the film, the Tom Cruise film. And Rosamund Pike was also in it. She's the Jane Bennett of Pride and Prejudice, the movie version from 2005. And it surprised me by how much fun this movie was and how thoughtful it was and how engaging it was. It wasn't dumb. It was a good mystery with appropriate action scenes, as you'd expect, but it wasn't over the top. I really enjoyed Jack Reacher. Interesting contrast between Jack Reacher and Javert, and that is, for Javert, the law was his God, and for Jack Reacher, as one character put it, he doesn't care about the law, he doesn't care about proof, he only cares about what's right. And he lived that out in the movie, and the bad guys get it, which is always fun for me. Anyway, I'm not recommending that because Jack Reacher isn't for everybody, but I enjoyed it. I do recommend Les Mis, and for the reasons that I mentioned. Okay, let's go to break. I'll come back to your calls here in just a moment on Stand to Reason.
Want to know what's going on with STR? Speaking events, new resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Post comments and interact with STR staff and other like-minded Christians. You can find all our social media connections at str.org.
Is God just a crutch? Was Jesus a fraud? Are science and faith antithetical? Christian apologist and philosopher Greg Kokel applies his trademark clear thinking to these and other vexing issues facing believers today in Faith Is Not Wishing, 13 Essays for Christian Ambassadors. Through this thoughtful approach, Greg demonstrates that Christian faith is not wishful thinking, but rather a sure conviction grounded in evidence. Visit Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org to get a copy of Faith Is Not Wishing, or call 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-REASON.
I'd like to extend to you an invitation to join with some others who are making a significant difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. And there is a special group of strategic partners who become the solid foundation of STR's ability to work effectively. Strategic partners are just what the name implies, people who've committed their regular financial support for Stand to Reason so that we can plan effectively to take advantage of opportunities for training and equipping. Now, they accomplish this by pledging to make a gift to Stand to Reason each month. If you'd like to become a part of this important group, just call 1-800-2-REASON today for more information. And we've selected some gifts of appreciation for those who stand with STR monthly as a strategic partner, and we'd like to give them to you. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about, both in the world and in the church, consider becoming a strategic partner today. Training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their faith and values. So call STR at 1-800-2-REASON to find out how you can sign up to become a strategic partner. Back with you here on Stand to Reason, and I was just discussing with the enforcer why I thought this ending of Les Mis was so bad, especially by contrast to the substantive issues that were dealt with in the film proper. And the reason it was so bad is it made the French Revolution look noble. And the French Revolution was one of the most ignoble events of near modern history, okay? And if you don't know that, then read Tale of Two Cities, and written by Dickens, you know, roughly during that time. And that, and there's, of course, there's lots of other examples of that, but Off with His Head, that's where that came from. Let's go to callers in Sykesville, Maryland. This is Craig. Hello, Craig. Welcome to Stand to Reason. You're the first for the new year.
Oh, thank you. It's an honor.
Thank you, Craig.
I also went to Les Mis and expectantly watched this film and looked forward to it with my family. I actually brought a small box of tissues and was handing them around the theater before the thing started.
Oh,
because I knew it was going to be like that.
And you needed them, right?
I did need them.
Well, good for you. There were many moments in that film where I was brought to tears, but I think that the scene with Fantine was the most powerful, because Hathaway, if she does not get at least a nod from the Academy, then something's wrong with the Academy.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And Jackman as well, although I know he's up against some other tough competitors for Best Actor.
Yeah, that's true. All right. What I would like to talk about is STR is so good about telling where they stand on contemporary issues,
mm-hmm.
yet I haven't heard your organization make a statement about media in general,
mm-hmm.
and I mean like Facebook and Twitter. Not long ago, Melinda didn't have to manage a Twitter account, and now she does.
Mm-hmm.
I'm mainly a podcast listener, but if I call into the radio show and this subject was covered on Twitter, I would have no clue about that because
mm-hmm.
I'm not a Twitter follower.
Mm-hmm.
So some listeners you have will call in and say, I'm having this conversation online with an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, I wish I'd hear you say, online conversations will have some impact, but your time is better spent developing face-to-face dialogue. And in John 3:13, John says, I had much better to write you, but I would rather not write it with pen and ink, but I hope to see you soon that we may talk face to face. The value of face to face is so important. But I mean, I would love to hear you. You've even mentioned your daughters interact with an iPad, and I've chosen not to do that with my family because of that's so strong, such a strong tool of the media.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Sure, I'll give you some thoughts on it and some of the reasons that we use media. I also share these interactive media things. I share your concern, and so we have fairly strict limitations on these things, and I'll describe those with regards to our own family. I see, let's just take the interaction with the atheists on the internet, okay, versus the face-to-face. My sense is for those people who are interacting with atheists on the internet, there is no alternative to a face-to-face of a face-to-face interaction. These people could be in another part of the world, much less, you know, another part. They could be, you know, anywhere all over the world, you know, not in their own town, not in a place where they can meet. I'm all in favor of face-to-face engagements when you can have them, but lots of times they are not the most effective way of getting your particular job done, considering the audience involved. When you think about it, the New Testament is all writing. Even though there were some things that were reserved for face-to-face conversations, we actually don't have a record of those. Those were lost. The thing that we have a record for, the thing that God preserved, was the written communication. And so I think there's a place for both. There's a place for the face-to-face when that's the opportunity one has. There's a place for the, you know, the interactive internet kind of thing. It has certain liabilities that I'll mention in a moment. But there's a place for that, especially when, for some people and some individual relationships, that's the only kind, that's the only opportunity they're going to have to talk together. Plus, whatever transpires in that conversation, at least in principle, is available to more than one person. That is, these other people who are reading the medium, they have access to that particular medium and are participating. So it's just like us looking over Paul's shoulder when he writes a letter to the Galatians, or more specifically, since Galatia was a region, let's just say to the Corinthians, because that was the local church. So we get to participate in that in the same way other people can participate in those online conversations. The liability for online is because it's not face-to-face, there is a temptation to abandon simple courtesies, and since there's a certain anonymity to the internet, particularly if you're not on Facebook, but you're just registered into a place where you're interacting, and the name that you registered with is some kind of fictitious handle that you're using. People don't know who you are, where you live, or anything, and that can bring out the worst in people. So there's a huge liability to that. So I'm let's make the best use of these mediums that we can for the gospel's sake and not limit ourselves to one kind of thing, but take opportunity when we're able to.
Yeah, I know, but, okay, for example, Pinterest, you guys are now on Pinterest too.
Well, yeah, and we may be. I don't know much about – Melinda's nodding, and I've heard people talk about Pinterest, but I have not ventured there. I couldn't even tell you what it is.
Except but I just would love to be
posting.
I would love to be a fly on the wall and hear you say, "There's this new thing out, and you know what? We're not going to do it."
The enforcer just mouthing something to me, but there are things that we've decided that we won't do. I don't have the full assessment of it, Of course, my question back to you might be, why would we say no to an opportunity just because it was media? Or social media.
Okay, but it does have its liabilities. Maybe I'm old-fashioned in the sense that I'm a podcast listener. Mm-hmm. Okay, and like I said, conversations going on Twitter currently about this subject, I have no clue as to what they are, and so that's a liability to any podcast listener. Right?
Wait. How is it a liability to a podcast listener simply because they are not in the flow of what's happening in another medium? I don't read newspapers either, but are newspapers a liability because I don't read them? I think there's still a means to an end, and the end can be good and noble, but it's unrelated to whether I make use of them or not.
But you still you have to be considerate of your staff and what they can handle.
That's true, too. Yes, that is. And I think the way that we assess these things is we look at the opportunities for communication. And by the way, if you think for a moment, think of all the value the podcast is to you. This is a fairly recent medium. A podcast is. The whole internet thing, well, of course, I'm 62, so for me, it's fairly recent. For many of our listeners, they grew up with it. But these things that we take for granted as central parts of our lives, as ways of being informed and educated, are historically rather new. And they were novel, unusual for at the beginning, and now they become such a part of our life, we don't know how we could live without them. Think of the cell phone. I panic if I forget my cell phone at home, kind of thing, because it's become so central to my life. I do Twitter and I do Facebook. Okay, those are the social media that I do. If I was not involved with Stand to Reason, I wouldn't do either, because right. I have no interest in having my time taken up by that kind of thing. Here are the reasons that I do each of them, and they're different for each medium. I do Facebook because I think that there's a benefit for people like you, Craig, and many others who follow Stand to Reason to be able to have access to the more mundane and human side of my life. So rather than just being a kind of an apologetics theological voice in your ear once a week, I am a human being who does woodworking and goes fishing and has daughters who have birthdays and blah, 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 these kinds of things. When I place those things before you to have a portal into my own life, I think it supplements or makes more valuable the entire experience that you have with Stand to Reason. I in a certain sense, I can do my job more effectively. I can have a more salutary influence in people's life if I take on the responsibility of tending to a Facebook. Now, all my responsibility is there is to try to post 4 or 5 times a week, and the enforcer posts sometimes for me when I'm traveling. She keeps people updated. But that, I think, a benefit accrues to us as an organization, where whatever mission that we're trying to accomplish is supplemented by that in a significant enough way to justify the time and effort we spend on it and the money we spend on it. The money isn't a lot. You know, I mean, this kind of interaction, the net is a good value in terms of, investment and return. Now, when it comes to Twitter, what I like about Twitter is it's, 146 characters or whatever it happens to be. My goal is to try to say something meaningful that gets people thinking. I don't know if you follow me on Twitter. Do you, Craig?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, that's...
Couldn't even tell me.
Okay, well, that's all right. Mike, when I see on my to-do list, try to put up a tweet today, then I what I'm looking at is, what can I say in 146 characters or whatever it is that will be worth somebody taking a look at it? I don't post 10 times a day. Oh, now I'm, you know, running down to the store to buy a carton of milk and some eggs. Hey, I don't do all of that. To me, that's a pain, and I don't know why anybody would be interested in that. I only want to put on Twitter something that will get people thinking theologically to the degree that they forward it. It's the leverage of Twitter that is the appeal to me. If I could say something that 100 people read that then advance it to the rest of their people, then maybe 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 people see this thing that I've spent maybe 10 minutes to construct. And that's leverage. That's a good use of my time. So I see that as an opportunity to have an impact for the kingdom in a person's life that is highly leveraged. That's the only reason I do it. People might use Twitter for other, maybe ignoble purposes. I'm trying to make good use of it there. When it comes to the children, they are very, very limited in the use of electronic stuff. They are not allowed to play with iPhones, except for when we take long trips in the car. And then they read or draw, or if it's an excessively long trip, like on their way to the studio and back, and that's roughly 2 hours each direction, and they come out with me with some frequency, then I allow them to have the iPad, and they're able to either draw or play some game or watch some movie, usually a Jane Austen movie, that we allow them to watch, and then they pass it back and forth in the back seat. So, but other than that, they are not... They do not traffic in the digital world. Annabeth reads roughly, I'd say, 4 to 5 books a week.
Wow.
Eva is just starting to read now. So we are really making sure that our girls are deeply, they're deeply word oriented, and they're not digitally oriented. But we do see some uses of it. They can't bring books or digital media to the table. That is an absolute no-no. Nothing like that ever happens. We don't even bring digital media to the table. It's not allowed at our home. And it's not allowed in restaurants. Now, occasionally I get a phone call or whatever. That's different. But we're not using these as modes of entertainment in public environments where the kids or adults should be interacting with each other. We just don't allow that. So I share your concern about some of these things and the negative impact they can have and the isolationist impact it can have on kids, and we're hot on top of that to make sure that this does not happen with our kids. We want them interacting, we want them talking, we want them listening to adults. We don't want them off in their own world. We're really vigorous not to allow that. However, we do see some value of these tools, and we want to use them in a reasonable fashion. Does that help you some, Craig?
Yes, and you know what? Even hearing you reflect on some of your household rules does help in the same way that how you're telling some of your traditions for Advent that helps give us things to wrap our minds around. We as parents all have our own rules that we're laying down, but it's nice to look over the shoulders of other people that are kind of going through the same struggle and figuring it out on their own.
Well, thank you. And these are all works in process, and we're in progress, rather. And we have to. Annabeth has a habit of kind of picking up books, and they're all over the place, and she reads a few chapters, and then she picks up something else and moves through. And so we don't know what she's completed. And so what we've had to do then is say, okay, we're choosing five books. They have a sticker on it. It's a post-it sticker, and mommy or papa's got their initials on it, and these are the books you're reading right now. You finish one book, you use a sticker to mark where you're at in the book, you finish it, you mark it on a list, and then you can get a new book and add to it. And so, you know, that afternoon, she had a finished book on my desk. I mean, within 2 hours, there's a finished book on my desk, because now we're requiring more discipline. And
right.
Now I got to go to break here in just a second, but this is important in general, because what I told her is, I said, Annabeth, you have very little discipline in your life because you're a child and not much is asked of children. Children get to do largely the things that they want. You're going to have to get more and more discipline in your life, because it's only through doing the things that you don't want to do that you're going to accomplish the things that are going to make your life rich and satisfying in the long run. And so we are imposing discipline here. We are now imposing discipline on you so that you will read more effectively. And it's not just about reading. It's also about discipline. Right, Craig?
Right.
It's about learning that this is a rule of life. Everybody is under authority for as long as they live. And the sooner you figure that out, the better. And the more you learn to do the things that you don't like to do, because they're the right things to do, the better you'll be as a human being. So that's the lesson, and here it is personified or exemplified in the list with the books and the process that we're going through. Someday in the future, we probably won't have to do that when she becomes disciplined herself in these areas, but for now, we impose that. So there's another little window into our life.
Thank you very much.
Craig, all the best to you. I appreciate your question and your thoughts on this.
Okay, bye.
Okay, all the best. All right, time to break, and I'll be back in just a moment on Stand to Reason.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? str.org is a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for. Before you turn to Google, log on to str.org, and you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse the range of topics, from our radio archives to advanced online training to our blog. You'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ and the tactics that will help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. Your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you take a stand for the truth. So visit today. That's str.org.
Greg Kokel back with you here, Stand to Reason, and my number, 1-800-227-5278. Let's, very interesting call coming up here. Let's talk with Dave in Valparaiso, Indiana. Valpo. That's a college town, isn't it, Dave?
Yeah, in fact, I'm a professor here. So,
oh, well, great. Super.
Yeah, yeah. And
what's your field? What's your field, Dave?
Mathematics.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just a visiting professor here, so I don't know if I'll be here a year from now. But,
okay, you're just balancing their books right now, huh?
yeah, I'm at the bottom of the totem pole.
Yeah, okay. What can I help you with, Dave?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting that your last caller called about the topic he did, because the thing that brought me onto this question actually was Facebook. There was a kind of a friend, somebody I don't know too well, who had been attending our church, and then he had left, and then recently I went on his Facebook page, and all of a sudden his status is no longer Christian, but atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, his likes are, you know, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and such.
Huh.
And immediately so all of a sudden, I mean, this isn't just like I've read about Dawkins and Hitchens and such, and all of a sudden the things about Dawkins and Hitchens have a bigger weight to me because, you know, here's this guy,
right,
you know, right down the street who's basically gone, nope, I don't want anything to do with Christianity, and you know, and I wouldn't have known that without Facebook.
Right, right.
But anyway,
that's a very interesting observation in light of the last caller. I have a question though, just for clarification's sake.
Yes.
Did you know this individual as a Christian before you found out that he became an atheist, or did you just see that?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Would you say that he was a serious Christian?
Well, here's the thing. His wife is still a member of the church. So that's one of the big weighty things that's been on my mind and my wife's mind. A year ago, we went to a Christmas party, and he was there through the church. And he was, you know, I'm a friend of a friend. I'm closer to friends than he knows. You
right,
know? I mean,
right.
That's the nature of Facebook, you know?
Right, of course. Well, the reason I'm asking is just, and even the fact that he was a member of the church, this doesn't always tell me the whole story. I would be a little bit surprised if someone was a genuine, it's hard to talk about these things sometimes because I don't want to sound like ultra critical of people, but there are a lot of people that are in the church that are not Christians or they are not followers of Jesus. They are part of Christendom and they're kind of going along with the cultural deal, but there's not much depth in their life. And so when they get hit by a Christopher Hitchens or a Richard Dawkins, they are unseated rather easily because they have no root. Now, I'm not trying to diss this man in any sense. I was just curious because I think it can happen that somebody who is a deeply serious Christian can be won over to atheism. I think certainly that's happened in the past, but I think that the people that are generally influenced by a Richard Dawkins or a Christopher Hitchens is somebody who does not have much substance in their own conviction to begin with. That's just it's not a scientific assessment of things. It's anecdotal. It's just, and that's why I was asking the question, just to see how it seemed to be in this particular person's case.
If I may just add one piece of the puzzle, obviously I really haven't had any conversation with this guy, but what I do know is that in the last year, the last 365 days, his younger brother died in a car crash.
Oh, okay.
I think
very interesting.
I think that's the domino that knocked it all over because it was he was a regular attender at the church up until that happened. I mean, it's
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things where all of a sudden it's, you know, here's a friend of a friend, and it's like, yeah, like I all of a sudden I have all these questions about Hitchens and Dawkins, but
okay.
It's more like, I know this guy, you know.
Sure. Well, let's deal with the question you have. There's a whole bunch of things going through my mind that I'd love to chat about in addition to what you have to say, but we're a little tight on the hour here. So go ahead. The issue.
So the issue at hand was, I mean, immediately I started looking up what Hitchens says and Dawkins said, and the one quote I heard Dawkins say was that, you know, basically he's exalting science and saying the meaningful questions in life are the how questions. How did this work? How did this come about? The questions of why, you know, why do we exist? Why does the universe exist? Those are silly questions. Those are frivolous questions. I think he compared it to, it's like asking, what's the color of jealousy? I think that was the Dawkins quote to say, well, this is just an opinion. This is just a.
Yeah. Well, when he says, what is the color of jealousy? He's giving an example of a category error. That is where you're asking a question about something that does not properly apply to that thing. Now, when you give the example of what is the color of jealousy, it is immediately apparent to everyone who hears the example that something is wrong with the question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they may not know that the right term for that is a category error, but they know that there is an error in play. All right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, so what Dawkins wants to convince the rest of the world of is that the greatest, deepest, most profound questions that man has asked since the beginning of recorded history are as meaningless or as incoherent, is probably a better way of putting it,
mm-hmm.
as asking what is the color of jealousy. Because I'll tell you what, it does, though the asking what the color of jealousy is obviously an incoherent question, it does not seem the least wise incoherent to ask why is something here rather than nothing is here.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that makes man different from animals? That's what we gas termites, not human beings. Why not? And we know intuitively it is not just something about self-preservation. That is not the reasons why we think we don't allow that. The reasons we think we don't allow that is because there is a difference between a man and a termite, and it is a qualitative difference. Now, what Richard Dawkins wants to do is to say, and wave his hand, you know, and just dismiss it. He doesn't even want to. It's almost like saying that it's silly is just too much trouble for him. Now, it may be silly for Dawkins, which is too bad for Dawkins, I guess, that for Richard Dawkins, what has occurred to most of thoughtful mankind as to being the most profound questions are meaningless to him. This might tell you more about Dawkins than it tells you about questions, but it is just patently false that the how questions are the more important ones. Now, in Dawkins' worldview, these are the only questions that can be asked because he's a materialist. So questions of meaning have no place in the materialistic universe. And so, therefore, if materialism is true, then asking questions like, you know, what is the meaning of life or something like that, turn out to be a category error since life isn't the kind of thing that has meaning on his view. But if that's what his view produces, then so much the worse for his view. Because it seems clear to everybody in play here who's thoughtful about it that the most important things for us to think about are the why questions of some sort. We don't go and watch a movie like Les Mis to ponder the economic causes of the French Revolution. We watch it to be able to reflect on the pathos and the ethos of the human predicament, not the how questions, the why questions. And we are moved to tears by what we confront because we identify with Fantine, and we identify with Jean Valjean, and we identify with Javert. In some sense, we are part of this struggle, and this has nothing to do with molecules clashing in the universe. They have to do with issues that transcend the material universe. And every great work of art and literature, with very few exceptions, is like that. And the only exceptions are those that are well done expressing the nihilism of the materialistic view that is produced. I should say the nihilism that is produced by the materialistic view of people like Richard Dawkins. And then you see art like The Scream or other things where there's this cry from the human soul of despair at this is all there is that all there is? And what Dawkins wants to say is yes, and if you think there's more, and if you're even asking the question, what an idiot. What a silly thing. All so much the worse for Richard Dawkins. So much the worse for Richard Dawkins.
If I may just piggyback on that, I totally agree with all that. I mean, obviously, this friend of a friend would say something different, but what kind of strikes me is there, what the sense I get from the Dawkins, the Hitchens, the you know Stephen Hawkins, the atheists, like there's almost kind of a nobility that they're saying, oh, our goal is to cure cancer or to predict earthquakes or to do like that's what drives them.
Listen,
you know?
Dave, the word nobility has no meaning in their vocabulary given their worldview. Because you've just taken a moral term, which moral terms are like asking the color of jealousy on their worldview. So just like questions about meaning are irrelevant, meaning questions are satisfied on an individual basis alone, then questions about morality are satisfied in the same way. And you're in Indiana. You can, Dave, I'm going to say goodbye to you, and I thank you for your call because I got to go at the end of the hour. But I want to start the next hour talking a little bit more about this because it's really important. So listen to the podcast, Dave, and you'll catch the rest of it. But I certainly appreciate your provocative call. Maybe we'll chat more about your friend in future calls. I'm Greg Kokel, hour number one behind us. Please stay with us for the next 2 hours. Welcome to Stand to Reason. A special welcome to the American Family Radio Network crowd. It's coming on board here for the first time this show. And a happy new year to you all. Always thrilled to have those 100-plus stations on board. And, of course, you're welcome to call in if you'd like, 1-800-227-5278. This is our first broadcast of the new year. And this month is the final month of my 23rd year. I think this is the end of 23 years. That's right, because I started in 1990, and so at 2013 would be the end of the 13th year, and the beginning, or make that the end of the 23rd year. And in any event, glad to be here still after all these years and being a part of your life, whether you're listening live or on podcasts, which you can do for no charge. STR.org is where you can find it. You can also find it at YouTube, or make that iTunes, and subscribe there at no charge, and then you get everything, including the first hour if you missed it. If you'd like to call in and get in the queue, 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code here in Southern California, you can dial direct 754-4150 and raise an issue, ask a question, lay it on me on anything in the area of ethics, values, and religion. I started out the show an hour ago. This is a little to whet your appetite a little bit for what you missed, talking about Les Mis, which is a film I saw last week and loved, and I gave some of the reasons why I think you ought to see it as well. And I also saw Tom Cruise and Jack Reacher, and really liked that one too, but for entirely different reasons. And for obvious reasons, I'm not going to recommend that movie. I'm just going to say that I liked it. I actually was surprised at the quality of the drama that it was. But in any event, that's over with. I want to talk about something else here as we start out this hour. It's actually a follow-through of something I was talking about last hour with a caller, Dave, from Valparaiso, Indiana. He's a professor there at the university, math department, has a distant acquaintance who, someone who he knew that had been a Christian and now is an atheist, and had posted on his website or on his Facebook or somewhere the point of view of Richard Dawkins that the how questions are more important than the why questions. The how questions, that is the questions of mechanism that a biologist like Dawkins is interested in, those are the ones that are most important. And that Dawkins is dismissive of the why questions, the why are we all here kind of thing, because these are how did he put this? These are silly was a word that Dave used, citing Dawkins. These are silly. These are ridiculous questions. These are incoherent. These are questions that are like asking, what is the color of jealousy? Which is a category error. Jealousy has no color, so it doesn't even make sense. It's incoherent to even raise such a kind of question. And he wants to say, Dawkins, and now the friend who's citing Dawkins, who used to be a Christian is now an atheist, wants to argue that questions of meaning are much like that. Now, I had a couple of observations, and one observation that I had was that if you adopt Dawkins's worldview, which is materialism, the material world, that which can be measured by science, is all there is. And therefore, if the material world is all there is, then the most important way of knowing something would be the way that one knows material things, and that would be through the enterprise of science. I won't say the scientific method because it's kind of a nebulous thing. There are a lot of things that fall under the scientific method, and it's no one particular thing, because some methodologies that apply to certain areas of science would not also apply to other areas of science in the same way. Different fields of science have different ways of knowing, if you will, and so this broad, let's just see, this broad discipline of science has a broad way of doing business, which is fine, okay? But you can see, of course, if materialism is true, then these other things are inconsequential. Now, it strikes me that the comment or the statement or the claim that the how questions are the most important questions is patently false. I understand that if you're a materialist like Dawkins claims to be, then there's nothing else. There can't be any other why questions, because if material is all that exists, then meaning itself is meaningless. Because meaning, especially transcendent meaning, is not a physical thing. It doesn't extend in space. You don't, you know, walk around the corner and bump into it by accident. Hey, look out, there's meaning right around the corner. If you're not careful, you'll hit the sharp edge. No, it is not a physical thing. And if only physical things exist, then even something like meaning doesn't exist. And so the only questions in principle that are available are the how questions. But then my caller, Dave, made an interesting observation, and he didn't realize what he was saying when he said it. Remember, Dave's on our side here, on my side. He's a Christian. But he's wondering now about guys like Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and the like in a way that he hadn't before, because now someone who he is in his circle of friends broadly has been influenced so much so by these people that he's abandoned his Christian faith. There is a little wrinkle, by the way, and the wrinkle is that this same individual suffered a significant loss. Not long ago, his brother was killed in a car accident, and this seems to be the genesis of the downward decline in his understanding, his views, etc., which resulted in his adopting of atheism. But the comment that Dave made that was significant, that he didn't realize it at first, is he said, well, these atheists, they just seem to think that they're involved in these noble causes like curing cancer and all the rest, just, you know, for the nobility itself kind of thing. And I said, wait a minute. If materialism is true, there are no noble causes. There can be causes, but they can't be noble. Because nobility, in the moral sense, is another one of those things, like meaning, that cannot exist in a materialistic world. Because if materialism is true, then nobility isn't something that extends in space. They might want to cure cancer, but they can't say the curing of cancer is noble, because that's to ascribe a virtuous quality to it. It is to ascribe some moral dimension to it, which moral dimension cannot exist in a material universe. And of course, Dave, being the bright guy he is, got it right away when I pointed it out. And this leads me to the thing that I want you to think about here at the beginning of this hour. And of course, you could be getting in the queue to talk to me about anything you want, 1-800-227-5278. But as you do that, I want you to think about something. Richard Dawkins is, as an atheist, qua atheist, in other words, this is part of the way atheism works. In virtue of his atheism, as a good card-carrying atheism, is dismissive of why questions, because these deal with issues of meaning, and these questions are incoherent on a materialistic view of the universe. Okay? However, these questions are not incoherent. Because asking questions like, pardon me, why is something here rather than nothing is here? Or asking questions about the meaning of the death, the tragic death of a close family member. And by the way, even to call it tragic is to import a moral notion into it. But it is the question we ask when those things happen. I actually lost two friends in the last few weeks. Christian workers. And to ask about the meaning of those things is to ask questions that have no relevance in a materialistic world, but they are relevant questions. And indeed, when you think about the kinds of things that men have labored over in their thinking and has spilled over into their art, their literature, their painting, their music, it has not been pondering the how questions, the deepest questions that human beings have ever asked. The ones that we labor over are the why questions. We know those questions are not incoherent. We know those questions are not insubstantial. We know that those kinds of questions are not silly and irrelevant, but they are of the most profound things we can think about. And if materialism as a worldview has no room for those questions, and it doesn't, then all the worse for materialism. I hope you see that this is one of the things that shows the failure of materialism, an atheistic worldview, to account for reality. Listen, a view is true in the classical use of the term true, the way most of us mean the word true when we use the word true. The view is true when the view matches the way the world really is, when the world is the way we think it is. In atheism slash materialism, there it is not true on that view that there's meaning in the world. However, we know better. The fact that we even struggle with the question means that we were made for meaning. Let me say that again. The fact that we struggle with the question means that we are made for meaning. We would not have a hunger for food unless there was food to satisfy the hunger. We would not have a thirst for liquids unless there were liquids to satisfy the thirst. And we would not have a hunger for meaning unless there was meaning to satisfy our hunger. Now, this is an argument from desire. C.S. Lewis develop this. It's a very straightforward, common-sensible notion. Now, some people have bought the bullet. They say, okay, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. Therefore, there can't be any meaning to these other things. Therefore, the how questions are the only questions that are left. Well, you got a point there. But if that's what atheism leads to, then that's a good evidence that atheism is not adequate to tell us the truth about the world. Because we experience many things in the world. We experience the physical world. We have five senses that allow us to do that with some accuracy, which what is one of the things that makes science work. But we also have other things that we are in touch with. And we are not in touch with them by our five senses. We are in touch with them through different faculty. And we are so powerfully in touch with them, things that relate to, say, meaning and morality and the like, that it is virtually impossible for us to part with those convictions. And if some worldview requires us to part with the convictions that these immaterial things are real, then so much the worse for that worldview. It's not telling you the truth about the world. When I did my three-hour radio debate with Michael Shermer a couple of years back, 3 years ago, just about now, on Hugh Hewitt's national broadcast, I ended my time, my final words, my parting shot was something to the effect of, I cannot bring myself to believe in atheism because it would require that I committed myself to some notions that were obviously false, that everything came from nothing, that life came from non-life, that consciousness comes from matter, that morality is just a trick that evolution played on us, that actual objective morality doesn't exist. These are so wildly counterintuitive that the point of view that requires me to believe such things must itself be inadequate. And therefore, I am a theist. I am specifically a biblical theist because the answers that biblical theism gives me makes sense of my deepest intuitions about the universe. That man who lost his brother in that car accident, he grieved for a reason. He grieved because it was tragic, and the tragic thing happened to somebody close to him. I'm curious what he thinks of such a thing now that he's an atheist. If the tragedy that he could not emotionally cope with, which I fully understand, that led him on his path to atheism. What does he make of that event? I'm not going to call it a tragedy now, because I don't know if you can do that as an atheist. Unless you're simply speaking descriptively, this person's life ended. But, you know, when you say it's a tragedy, you're saying something else. You're saying it ended, and it shouldn't have ended. Or it shouldn't have ended that way, or it shouldn't have ended at that time. But see, shouldn't have is a phrase that you can't use in a materialistic worldview. And you see, what this man has done is he hasn't, when he got rid of God, he didn't get rid of his problem. He didn't get rid of the tragedy. He just got rid of a solution. Now he's got to make sense of what happened based on the resources that materialism gives him, and that's precious few. Indeed, he's got to abandon this. He's got to say, well, now I'm an atheist, and that turns out to be, to have been just a meaningless episode to which I had an understandable emotional response, but that's all I can say about it. To which I had an understandable emotional response. I was emotionally attached to something that did something emotionally to me, and here we're talking about, I avoided the word valued, something I valued, because that's beginning to stray from materialism. I had chemical reactions regarding a person in my life, and now that they're gone, I have different chemical reactions in my body, and these are not chemical reactions I like. That's what you've got. But then I have to ask the question, is that all there is? Because that's all that's left you on a materialistic view. But doesn't the person who lost the brother say to themselves, it's not just a chemical reaction in my nervous system? That was a tragedy. Well, if that's what he's haunted by, well, then he's got to admit that his materialism is not adequate to explain reality. And if it doesn't explain reality, then it isn't true. Something else must be true. A lot to think about there. I'm compelled by the view of the world of Jesus of Nazareth, precisely because it does the best job of making sense of everything, even of science, by the way. Because where did the uniformity come from? The uniformity that science measured. What accounts for that? That's not an important question. Well, I guess not to Richard Dawkins. All right, 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code, dial direct 754-4150 for Stand to Reason.
Want to know what's going on with STR? Speaking events, new resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Post comments and interact with STR staff and other like-minded Christians. You can find all our social media connections at str.org.
Is God just a crutch? Was Jesus a fraud? Are science and faith antithetical? Christian apologist and philosopher Greg Kokel applies his trademark clear thinking to these and other vexing issues facing believers today in Faith Is Not Wishing, 13 Essays for Christian Ambassadors. Through this thoughtful approach, Greg demonstrates that Christian faith is not wishful thinking, but rather a sure conviction grounded in evidence. Visit Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org to get a copy of Faith Is Not Wishing, or call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason.
I'd like to extend to you an invitation to join with some others who are making a significant difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. And there is a special group of strategic partners who become the solid foundation of STR's ability to work effectively. Strategic partners are just what the name implies, people who've committed their regular financial support for Stand to Reason so that we can plan effectively to take advantage of opportunities for training and equipping. Now, they accomplish this by pledging to make a gift to Stand to Reason each month. If you'd like to become a part of this important group, just call 1-800, the number 2, and the word Reason today for more information. And we've selected some gifts of appreciation for those who stand with STR monthly as a strategic partner, and we'd like to give them to you. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about, both in the world and in the church, consider becoming a strategic partner today. Training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their faith and values. So call STR at 1-800, the number 2, and the word Reason to find out how you can sign up to become a strategic partner.
I remember the days of just keeping time, of hanging around in sleepy towns forever.
Greg Kokel back with you here, Stand to Reason. And, you know, I was just thinking about my previous comments about morality, among other things, and meaning and materialism and the like. And just for the record, I am perfectly aware that atheists have an accounting of morality, and it's an evolutionary accounting. I have books on my shelves, that many books that make this case, all right? I am not the least wise persuaded by it, because in part, the only thing that evolution is capable of producing is the illusion of morality, not real morality. And it doesn't take, you know, a PhD in biology to realize that an objective moral obligation is not something that is physical. Yet evolution is a materialistic system, and materialistic systems can only produce other material. They can't produce immaterial things. The best that evolution can do, if it succeeds in the morality game, is give you relativistic morality. Even though you mistakenly believe it's objective, it's not really. You've been tricked by evolution to believing that because it helps. It has some reproductive function or survival benefit. Listen, I understand this completely. In fact, I am going to spend some time this year writing on it. I've written on it in the past, so I'm going to do some more. If you want any clarification of this, read Michael Ruse. Michael Ruse, the atheistic evolutionary philosopher from University of Florida, I believe, in Gainesville, and he's a contemporary philosopher that is really in the same vein as the 20th century philosophers, who all got it right. If there is no God, there is no objective morality. Period. All you've got is emotions, you've got chemistry, you've got illusions, but you don't have objective morality. Anyway, there you go. Let's go back to our callers in San Jose, California. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg.
Hey.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love what you're doing. Happy New Year. Congratulations on 23 years.
Thank you.
I was thinking the great why question that I wish Richard Dawkins would answer would be why he would never debate William Lane Craig, especially when he was there 2 years ago in England.
That was last year, and that's a great, yeah. That is a good for you. Well, he'll probably respond, that why question is not a meaningful one. You know.
Yeah, well, the how is real easy. You just call him up and set up a date.
Absolutely. Nothing mysterious about that. Yeah.
My question is actually something you said, it was many months ago, and you just kind of said it as a quick line, almost like a Twitter line, and then went on to another topic, and I called the next week that you were gone and you had a guest host on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to come back and just get it was intriguing to me, and you had just said in passing that when the meanings of words are changed, people die.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw some applications to abortion, right away, but I wondered if there are other meanings beyond that, and if you had a moment to
I think I first heard the phrase from my friend Michael Bauman, who's a professor over at Hillsdale College. And I think there's profound insight in it. And it's not just, I don't think that he coined the phrase. I think he's passing it on. But the notion has been around for a long time. Now, you just think of George Orwell, for example.
Sure.
And 1984. There was a concept in that book. Now, for people who maybe not be up to speed in this, 1984 is not a book about the past. It was a book written in the distant past about the future, and 1984 at the time was the future. But it's about the human predicament and the tendency of government to take power in draconian ways and manipulate. And in this particular book, he talked about the way language was abused, and what did he call it? Something speak. I can't remember.
Double speak.
Okay, there you go. Thank you. And you get a clear picture about how language is abused to create mischief and for people to get their way. And ultimately, the mischief that often is caused is that people end up dying. And I think this is certainly the case with abortion and the pro-choice, for example, or postnatal abortion, or that was my term. What was the one the philosophers had last year? It's called afterbirth abortion. Okay, this is the term that they came up with. I predicted something like this would take place. My term was postnatal abortion. I was right in my prediction, but wrong in the precision of the words there. If you think about what the Nazis accomplished in the 40s with the final solution, notice the double speak there. But you also see the same thing happen, something preparing them for it in the 30s, where they began to execute essentially undesirables of all sorts, including physically undesirables. But they used a bunch of euphemistic phrases in order to accomplish this, to make it look like something good. So these are all examples of the way language is used as like double speak, right? Is that was our phrase? And the meanings changing meanings of the words result in people dying, because obviously pro-choice is that's a euphemism for killing an unborn child. Instead of calling it killing an unborn child, we'll call it pro-choice.
Right, or you're cleaning up the products of conception.
Oh, yes, what's the other, we want to commit genocide. Let's call it the final solution and therefore sanitize it. Now, I'm digging around in my notes right now because I grabbed an article that I was going to comment on sometime. Here it is, that makes the same point. The title here, this is from the Telegraph in London. The headline says, half of those on Liverpool care pathway never told. What's this about? Well, this is about their medical system. And what is the Liverpool care pathway? Well, a care pathway? Doesn't that sound nice?
Yeah.
It's like, I want to be on the care pathway. The care pathway is the medical route that is chosen for a patient in which they remove all necessary, I don't want to say life support, because it isn't life support. It does support life, but they are water and food from patients who the doctors think are unworthy to continue living. And so water and food aren't medical treatment, they're care. Okay, and they had been given this care in virtue of the fact that they were human beings who needed hydration and nutrition in order to survive, and the doctors are going to take care of their other maladies. In this circumstance, they are put on what's called the care pathway so that the care can be removed from them, not given to them. And what this article is about, since this is a fairly common practice now in Great Britain, The article is about those people who are put on the care pathway and who are not told that they are being put on the care pathway. So this is non-voluntary euthanasia. This is killing the patient without their consent, and they're not given their consent. So, but look at the language. Care pathway. That's what attracted me to this piece, is the abusive language. You know, you change the language and people lose their lives. Change the meaning of words and people die. What is the care pathway here? Euthanasia. That's what care pathway means. It doesn't mean care. It means death. So there's another example, a contemporary one.
Well, thanks. We don't have to belabor it, but just it helps me. We just have to be careful with how we use our words. And
yes.
On our terms.
And how we allow others to use words in our presence, or when I say in our presence, I mean in the larger sense, in our cultural presence, we need to point things like this out. I said, that's misleading. That's Orwellian. That is an abusive language to make something ugly sound good. And it's not good, so we should use language that makes it sound good. We should use language that makes it sound bad. By the way, I remember an ad once for Volvo, and this was an example of taking a liability and bragging about it, which is a marketing principle. That is, if you have something that some people view as a liability, you try to find the good side of it, and you bring that forward. And here's what they said. Apparently, Volvos did not run. They ran smoothly at like 50 and 60 at some time in the past. But when you got them up to 80 miles an hour, they ran a little rough. Okay? So how are they going to market this car now when it's not running so smoothly at 80 miles an hour? Well, they said if you're driving 80 miles an hour, it shouldn't feel like you're driving 60. That's dangerous. That was pretty clever, wasn't it?
Yes, very clever.
Yeah, it should feel like you're driving 60. You know, if you're going at dangerous speeds, you don't feel it's dangerous. That now you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing principle is on here. We shouldn't be talking about dangerous things as if they're something beautiful, because now we are lulled into complacency by the words. This is doublespeak. This is Orwellian. This is when words lose their meaning and people lose their lives. I think that's the phrase, by the way. When words lose their meanings, people lose their lives. Okay, Scott?
All right. Hey, thank you. Keep up the good work.
Okay, I appreciate the call. It was a lot of fun talking about that. And my friend Michael Bauman, a professor over at Hillsdale, is also a professor during the summer at Summit Ministries. That's where I get to see him teaching their good students. Let's go to Dallas and Sean. Hello, Sean. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Mr. Kogel. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I appreciate your show and your work. I told your screener, I'm agnostic, really. I've really been kind of thinking through the arguments. I appreciate them. One of the things you said earlier in your debate with Michael Shermer, I believe, is that mm-hmm. who you referred to?
Yes.
You had mentioned that at the end of it, you said that so much of what it takes to be an atheist is counterintuitive to believe
right.
that life comes from non-life, et cetera.
Right.
And the thing that I guess I wrestle with on that point is that Christianity seems non-intuitive. And I think for someone like myself, who's really trying to reconcile truth and what it is that I want to commit my life to, when I look at Christianity and I hear somebody tell me it's not non-intuitive, it makes me really worry something smells bad, because there's so many non-intuitive things about Christianity that to make the argument that's why you're not an atheist almost seems disingenuous. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, it wouldn't be disingenuous in my situation, because I am being genuine when I say that. You might mean that I'm being unsound or inaccurate, or maybe I'm not
okay.
taking everything into consideration. And I
okay,
don't and I don't deny that there are difficulties in certain aspects of Christianity, theological difficulties. And we can talk about your concerns in just a moment, but I have often said, in fact, I said it again just a day or two ago to someone, that the biggest problems, in my view, with Christianity are not external, that is, the apologetics-type challenges, but are internal, which are the theological ones. And there it becomes, it's more complex and more difficult. And this is where it's not as tidy, you know, as I would like it to be. I like things tidy. As far as the external issues, though, I don't think that that's where the big problems lie. Now, a lot may hinge here on what one means by an intuition, and I mean something fairly particular by it. Maybe you mean something different. And when you say that Christianity is not intuitive, or it violates the intuitions, you know, I'd be curious to find out what it is that you think does that. And I'm not sure if you're talking about Christianity in particular, or theism in general is non-intuitive.
Well, with respect to Christianity in particular, maybe you can help me with this. And I honestly am being sincere with this.
Yes, I take it
want
that
to
way.
Go, yeah. So, for instance, I would say that the idea of a finite life determines an infinite existence. To me, there's something counterintuitive within that. There's something where if I fall on the wrong side of the fence on my decision with Jesus, let's say, my finite life and decision now leads me to an infinite and eternal punishment.
Mm-hmm.
That seems inherently counterintuitive. I'm not saying it's wrong any more than the idea that something can come from nothing is wrong. I'm saying it's counterintuitive and problematic.
Well, it seems
one example.
It seems disproportionate.
Yeah.
Is that a fair way of putting it? Now, I agree with you there. I do think that when you reflect on eternity and eternal punishment, I do think that it's disproportionate. However, I just want to I'm not saying I think it is disproportionate. I say I'm sympathetic to people who believe that. I mean, I can understand how people respond that way. Okay. But there's something else that may be at play here, and let me just to pique your curiosity or whet your appetite for this, or I guess you got an appetite already, to get you thinking. give you something to think about, and that is when a person, let's say, executes somebody else, point blank, gun to the head, boom, summary execution. How long does it take to accomplish the act? A split second, right?
Right.
But most people would consider that it minimally life in prison is an appropriate punishment.
Mm-hmm.
So if we think about it, and this is where I think sometimes our intuitions, what we think are intuitions, may be not well informed, and we have to think more about it, and somebody's got to offer a perspective from the other side, and then things get shuffled out a little bit here.
But
they think, well, you know, if I'm thinking that the amount of time it takes for me to do something wrong has to be somehow proportionate to the amount of time I'm punished, well, that doesn't actually seem to work, because I admit that if somebody shoots someone, it takes a second to commit the crime, but it is the weight of the harm,
mm-hmm,
that needs to commensurate with the level of punishment, not the amount of time of the harm that needs to be commensurate with the amount of time of the punishment.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you so far?
It does. Okay, I like the way you framed it. I think that makes sense. Help me with this aspect of the analogy. I do think that because it is a life for a life, that's apples and apples.
Uh-huh.
It's not the amount of time that it took me to kill them and then I go to jail for life.
Uh-huh.
It's a life for a life.
Uh-huh.
So in that sense, because it's a life for a life, that would make sense to me. So how does that correlate then to my finite existence making a choice here with an infinite punishment then?
Yeah,
how does that correlate?
But what you've just jumped to now is you've jumped into the temporal element. You're comparing time for time here, and that's not the proper comparison. When you say life for life, and that's the idea, the Old Testament notion of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is meant to employ just punishments for the crimes mm-hmm. committed. That is, that the punishment has to be commensurate with the crime. That's the point there.
Okay.
It's not barbarism. So, people have misunderstood that notion. But when you say, well, I can understand if somebody takes a life, they should give their life, you are acknowledging that the sacrifice of life, of one's own life, is commensurate to the level of harm that was done, and that's the real
right.
issue, okay? So
okay.
now, what is the crime that is in question with regards to the judgment issue that pertains to the heaven and hell question?
Okay, so clearly it would have to be the idea of rejection or unbelief that's based off of, in Christian theology, my understanding would be that because I have sinned, that, and then I reject God, that would be in a sense the crime. Is that accurate?
Yeah, let me dial it down a little bit more, because something else was working in there. The issue of belief is not the issue. And I think Christians, in trying to communicate their own convictions, have sometimes misunderstood this or not explained it clearly. People don't go to hell because they don't believe in Jesus. This would be like saying that a person died because he didn't go to the doctor. His not going to the doctor didn't kill him. There was a disease that killed him. The doctor might have saved him, but it is not the lack of going to a doctor that was the cause of death. All right? It's just a handy illustration. I don't want to press it too far. But by the same token, a person doesn't go to hell because they didn't believe in Jesus. The reason that they are punished is the same reason any criminal is punished, and that is he's rebelled against his proper sovereign by breaking the law of the realm, the appropriate laws of the realm. Now, in the case of human beings, this is an ongoing attitude of rebellion, and this is where I think it's more difficult for us, especially since each of us is the criminal in this case. It's more difficult for us to understand the gravity of it. And in one sense, we can think, well, you know, okay, maybe I deserve something, but like forever? That's a bit much.
Right.
And so
that
is the response I'm sympathetic to, okay?
Mm-hmm.
However, I think part of what we have to take into consideration is that we are dealing with the not just the head of state, if you will, but the sovereign creator of all the universe, who is, on the Christian worldview now, the standard of moral perfection, who is perfect holiness. And when one considers our state, the rebellion and all that goes with it compared to God's perfect holiness, we're really bad. And so, and it's hard for us to get in touch with it. Like some people say, well, I'm no Hitler. And my response is, well, yeah, you're no Hitler, but you're no Jesus Christ either. And you're a lot more like Hitler than you are like Jesus, if you consider Jesus morally perfect. So, so that's the kind of standard in view. Now, we can, I'm talking about it somewhat in the abstract, because I don't think that you and I can connect with this in the fullness of it, just because we're the limited ones and we're the ones that are the guilty ones. So this is part of what I think makes the eternal separation from God thing look a bit extreme. Okay, so I acknowledge that. But let me just toss in one other thing. What is the alternative? Yeah. Well, I could say, well, there is no God. Okay, well, if that's true, then the whole moral thing seems to fall flat on its face. And that seems to be more inadequate. And this is part of the atheism is too counterintuitive for me. Whatever I come up with, I've got to come up with a system that makes sense of morality, and no materialistic system is going to do that.
Which is why I'm not atheistic. I'm agnostic.
Of course.
And because I do agree with you, which is why I'm intrigued by your show, and I appreciate the argument you're using. My bigger question is Christianity the alternative?
Mm-hmm.
I ask that because I could conceive of, I have a friend who's a very strong Christian, and he talks to me about Jesus as the great physician, how he is the healer.
Mm-hmm.
The question I asked him is, as any physician would do, a physician would heal people, even if it was against what they wanted because they knew it was what was best for them. So my question is, I know you got other callers and I want to respect that.
Yeah.
I genuinely am pursuing and seeking and searching. My mind probably gets the best of me at times. And so my question, I guess, is, does God have the ability to apply his mercy to somebody, even to the end, if they just intellectually couldn't get there?
Well, the answer to that is, on my view, is yes. Absolutely. I want to point out, though, that your particular point about physicians isn't actually true. Because physicians, and there's a lot of Christians that will follow this further than I'm willing to, but I just make the observation, the physicians have to respect the autonomy of the patient. If the patient is dying of a disease and the physician offers his services, the patient can say, no, thank you, I'm going to go home and die in my bed. And they have nothing. There's no recourse for a physician under those circumstances. So this is a parallel, some would argue. I want to be careful personally how I argue it in terms of my own theological convictions, but some will certainly argue that there's a parallel there. And I do think that we have a part to play and a say on this. However, my specific answer to your precise question is, yes, God is capable of doing that, and I think sometimes does that. He can get what he wants done, and he is capable of changing people's hearts who are not intellectually convinced. He can still draw them into to himself. In fact, in my case, I had all kinds of intellectual problems with Christianity. I probably was not as thoughtful about it as you have been. I was somebody who pretty much wanted my own autonomy. I was more interested in that. And I wanted to lead the life that I wanted to live. This was in the 60s and the early 70s. And I was a young man, and there was a lot of appeal to that at that time. And the culture was certainly willing to accommodate that. And still, God got a hold of me. And I became a follower of Christ when I was 23 years old at UCLA. And it wasn't until after that all of my intellectual issues began to be dealt with. And so in my case then was a true life example of the answer to your question. God persuaded me in a fashion that's hard to describe, but it was not based on answering all the intellectual issues. And I have other friends that it was quite the opposite. It was dealing with all of these intellectual stumbling blocks that was the entree for them to become Christian. So, Sean, I hope we have other conversations in the future, and I'm glad you're listening to the show, and I look forward to you calling
thank
again.
Thank you.
Okay?
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yes, all the best to you, and have a happy new year. Quick break now, and then we'll come back to our final caller this hour.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? str.org is a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for. Before you turn to Google, log on to str.org, and you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse the range of topics. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our blog, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ, and the tactics that will help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. Your visit to SDR.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you take a stand for the truth. So visit today. That's SDR.org.
Greg Kokel back on Stand to Reason. Stay with us for our next hour. At the beginning of the hour, J. Warner Wallace will be my guest here. Probably the first time we've been in this. He's been in the studio. He hasn't been sitting in my seat, I think, at least with me. That coming up, we're short on this segment, so let's quickly go to, let's see, who's next? Who do I have there? Jack in Buffalo? Okay, let's go to Jack in Buffalo, New York. Jack, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
How you doing, Greg?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, first I want to say thanks for this is my first time calling, but thanks for you really kind of been the person I'd go to learn about objective morality. Your,
uh-huh.
your website's been very helpful.
Great.
I just got a couple quick just a quick question,
uh-huh.
and I know you gotta get back, but what kind of led me on this journey here? I mean, let me start by saying I am a strict believer in Jesus, and
mm-hmm.
I kind of grew up in a Christian household.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a talk with a friend of mine at work, and he was an atheist, and he brought up a lot of, a lot of the scary questions. Atheists,
mm-hmm.
he's kind of a new atheist kind
mm-hmm.
of person, real smart person.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things that kind of got me nervous, and I see it a lot in debates, is when they talked about when – like you and, or I know J.P. Moreland uses it a lot, but he talks about, if you come to Jesus, a lot of Christians get their prayers answered. And my atheist friend, one of his rebuttals was that, but if there's a lot of people that are Muslims that get their prayers answered as well. And I was just curious on what you would have to say about
that. Okay, and that's a rebuttal to what? What does the, even if that were true, how does mm-hmm. that help the atheist?
Well, they're just trying to diminish Christianity, saying
okay.
that.
Well, I believe that God listens to prayers of non-Christians. Now, it has to be qualified. I don't think he's made promises to people like he has to Christians with regards to prayer. But if you look in Acts chapter 10, there's Cornelius, who's the God-fearer. He is not a Christian. In fact, Peter goes to his home. He's a Gentile. He says he gives alms, and his prayers have risen to God. God heard Cornelius's prayers. So God does hear the prayer of the non-Christian. Now, when I say he hears, I mean that he responds. It isn't the case that he will not respond to a non-Christian prayer. It also isn't the case that he has commitments to non-Christians to answer their prayers on a regular basis the way he asks, he answers ours. All right? So if
okay.
it turns out that God hears the prayer of a Muslim and answers it, all right, I'm not going to beef with God about that. But that doesn't mean that Muslim theology is accurate theology. As far as that goes, that's a different issue. What I do not believe that your atheist friend who offered the issue actually believes that God answers Muslim prayers. Because if he did, he wouldn't be an atheist.
Oh,
I don't even think
right.
he knows Muslims who have had their prayers answered. I would be surprised if that were the case. These are people who say things that they have that to throw you off base, so to speak, but there's no necessary. It doesn't mean that their point is necessarily valid. So they'll say, well, I've heard this. All these other religions have all their Bibles with all their evidences, too, just like you. Really? Where? Tell me what religion has its Bibles with all its evidence. No other religion has its Bibles with all its evidence. This is unique to biblical Christianity, okay, and biblical religion. So they say these things, even though they don't know what they're talking about. If an atheist told me that, you think God answers your prayers? Well, he answers the prayers of Muslims, too. I would say, how do you know that? Well, Muslims have told me God has answered their prayers. Okay, then why aren't you a theist? If you believe God answers prayers, then why are you still an atheist?
I gotcha.
You see, he's just trying to trip you up. I don't think he believes any of that, and I'd be surprised if he ever talked to him. Now, Muslims might have said God answers my prayer. I'm not going to get into a debate on that. The question isn't whether God answers prayers of non-Christians. The question is whether Christian theology is accurate and sound or not, or is Muslim. And that's a different question. If God exists, if God exists and I think there's good reason to believe he does, then is the Muslim characterization of God a better one than what Jesus offered? And that's the way I'm going to approach it. Go ahead.
Okay, I know you got to end this hour, but I was just going to ask you one other quick question.
We got 1 minute. Go ahead.
Okay, the same person who questions, why did God come during that period of history? Like almost as if he just left enough clues for you to believe.
Well, you can't. This is an impossible circumstance. Okay, because.
Okay.
If God were to come in any period of history, pick any period of history, whatever period of history it is, it will always have to be a period of history regarding which people in other periods of history could say, why did God come in that period of history? It's like saying, God came on Wednesday. Well, why did he come on Tuesday? All right, he's coming on Tuesday. Well, why did he come on Wednesday? You're stuck. It's not a very helpful question. If God is going to visit the planet, he's going to have to visit at some time in history. The question is whether we now, looking back 2,000 years, have adequate reason to trust that what was written 2,000 years ago gives us accurate characterization of what really happened. And by the way, that's a great segue into our next segment we're coming up with Jay Warner Wallace. So thank you so much for the call, Jack in Buffalo, New York, and stay tuned for our final segment here, or our final hour on Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel. Jay Warner Wallace coming up in just a moment. The beef is sitting right across from me right now. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, our final hour together, and I got a nice surprise visit from Buddy, who many of you know because he's sat in this seat many times when I've been out of town. In fact, I don't know if we've ever been in the studio together, Jim.
I think we have. We did one interview about, maybe a couple of years ago we did an interview together. But it's so much nicer to be on this side of the mic than on that one.
Jay Warner Wallace, Buddy... Kind of former cop, almost done.
Yeah,
got a little
done.
More work to do, a couple more weeks maybe, and then he'll be full-time with Stand to Reason. And I just remember the first time that I heard you do the show, Jim. And now I call him Jim, but he goes professionally by Jay Warner because there's another Jim Wallace who stresses his last name differently, and he's got way different politics than you do. So we just don't want to confuse them, another guy in the Christian world. So in any way, Jim, Jay Warner. I was in an airport. I was at SFO in San Francisco, and you were filling in for me because I was working there Sunday morning. And I thought, well, I'll just crank up my STR app here in my iPhone and see what Jim's got to say. And man, it was so great listening to you on the air. And you had only filled in for me one or two times, I think, at this particular point. And I think that was the circumstance that motivated me to finally grab you by the collar. And we'd been talking about this on and off for years and say, okay, Jim, it's time for you to leave the police force behind. You 25 years with the Torrance PD, great cold case detective. It's time for you to now give your efforts, all the salutes to him. Give your efforts full time to the kingdom because you do such a great job. And we got together at Houston's and had dinner and we went to the mat, and I won.
Yeah, you did. As a matter of fact, the whole name thing, you won also, because I was Jim Wallace until I met you. Now I'm Jay Warner. Well, yeah. I actually was using that name before in search warrants and stuff. But, yeah, I think it is helps to kind of clarify the distinction between the two guys. But that was you who called me and said, hey, you need to change your name. I thought, what are we going to do about this? Yeah, I got to change my name now.
Well,
yeah.
But fortunately, you had been using Jay Warner professionally.
Yeah, I
so
been.
It wasn't
yeah.
too big of a
no,
change,
no.
And it was handy. And it sounds clever. It sounds like you're more educated than you actually probably are.
For sure. And my grandfather's name is Warner. It's a very unusual name, and I hated it growing up because I thought, until I met my grandfather and got to know him really well.
Mm-hmm.
As a real young kid, who had a name like Warner? Mm-hmm. But actually, it ends up being a kind of an honor to him, too. So,
what's really great about having you on board, in addition to the fact, and, you know, don't roll your eyes at me. You're going to say some nice things. Good. I know it makes you really uncomfortable, but you're a fabulous communicator. You're really great with multimedia stuff, and you really know your stuff. We're going to talk a little, very briefly, about your book that's just come out here. But it's so great to have your background in the police force, and not just police work in general, but being a cold case detective, what you're able to learn about how evidence works. As I understand it, this was a significant thing in influencing you as an atheist to come to the Lord.
Yeah, what you learn about, I definitely remember using the tools that I learned as a detective, forensic statement analysis, for example. I'm not sure where I would be if I didn't have those tools to approach the Gospels in the way I did. I mean, mm-hmm. God will do what God will do, but I definitely employed the skill set that mm-hmm. I had. I was the guy who you would typically go to if you needed a confession from somebody. So I was always in.
Not a priest type, but
type. Yeah, a cop out, basically. And I was always really fascinated by word choices and how people, deception indicators, those kinds of things were always fascinating to me because
mm-hmm.
they were useful when you're talking to a bad guy. And so I can't help but read every email, every note that's given to me, I'm always trying to read between the lines.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what as soon as I picked the Gospels up, that's the first thing I did was try mm-hmm. to read between the lines.
Mm-hmm. What stood out for you, and we'll probably have a whole hour where we talk about this, mm-hmm. but I am curious, as an atheist, cold case murder detective, homicide mm-hmm. detective, who's skilled in these things, who over years and years of practice have gained a sixth sense about a lot of this. We're going to talk about mm-hmm. Just a moment about a case just solved. You gained a sixth sense about this. When you went to the text, the gospel text, what were some of the first things that jumped out at you?
Well, first of all, I'd be very careful about that case tomorrow we're talking about, because that's still unresolved. But when it comes down on Dateline, we'll be able to talk about it quite a bit. But today, I'm going to get in big trouble with my district attorney say anything about it today. Yeah. But I can tell you that when I first read the Gospels, what was powerful for me was what I called – and remember, I opened those Gospels up not because I was even interested in Jesus as God or whether or not there was – I simply was interested in the sort of wise, time-tested words of an ancient sage.
Hmm.
So I'm looking at the Gospels simply to kind of mine out what does Jesus have to say about
my
life.
You're an atheist, though,
at the time. Oh, yeah. Oh, no doubt. I mean, there's no way I would have accepted Jesus as God.
Mm-hmm.
He was I remember as a high schooler, I had a sociology teacher who was Baha'i. And mm-hmm. so I remember reading the words of Baha'u'llah, kind of his mm-hmm. proverbial wisdom. I had a kind of fortune cookie view mm-hmm. of these sound bite pieces I was interested in.
Incidentally, this is I've mentioned this before, but since you brought it up, I just want to draw attention to it again, Jay Warner, and that is that this is a huge benefit for us as followers of Jesus of Nazareth, because he has very high IQ in our culture right now. People have a high view of Jesus.
Yes.
Even though they don't think he's the Son of God and the only way of salvation and all of these things these crazy Christians think about him, he still is a force to be contended with, and which is why people try to get him on his team, on their team.
Yeah.
Like, well, Jesus never said anything against homosexuality. Well, why should it matter? Because Jesus is an important figure. So here for you, even as an atheist, this had play for you.
Oh, absolutely! I could definitely testify to that. As an atheist, it does have. I was interested in those words, and mm-hmm. I only purchased that first $6 pew Bible for the purpose of looking at Jesus' words. But you have to read through the Gospels to get them. And as I read through them, the thing that really stuck out for me is something I call unintentional eyewitness support. It's something that J.J. Blunt, a pastor in the 19th century, called an undesigned coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is an example of two eyewitnesses coming in and giving an account of an event they saw or they experienced firsthand. Yet
raising as many questions as they answer, because mm-hmm. the way they describe the account leaves open questions. This happens a lot in real criminal cases. Mm-hmm. You'll see two people who will witness the same event, and they'll offer an explanation of the event. And you're thinking to yourself, how in the world could that even have happened the way they just described it? It makes no sense to me. And then, of course, the next person comes along, the next witness, who hasn't really heard what the first witness had mm-hmm. to say, and they end up answering the questions raised by the first witness unintentionally.
The puzzle pieces fit together.
The puzzle pieces come together. Huh. And what makes them powerful evidentially is not, and I always say this, when examining the scriptures, I saw the same thing in the mm-hmm. Gospels. And that was powerful for me, at yeah. least to say, wow, there's a flavor here. Mm-hmm. Not to say that I'm assembling a circumstantial case. Mm-hmm. And so this is just one more piece of this larger circumstantial case.
Sure, but when you read this, I mean, you're starting to see indicators that there's a certain authenticity to these reports,
right.
as opposed to kind of a third or fourth century fabrication where people are trying to invent something that supposedly happened hundreds of years earlier or even
right.
50 years earlier. These seem to be the kinds of things that you'd expect to see in documents that these things purport to be.
Right. And so I looked at that and I said, look, as a skeptic, I still would try to, you know, rationalize that this could be just if you write enough words, mm-hmm. you're likely to accidentally stumble into a few of these kinds mm-hmm. of incidents. So I was always kind of looking at it and saying, is that just a kind of an artifact of how many documents we have mm-hmm. and how much has been written about Jesus? Or is there something about that really – and for me, it starts to cross the line a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I was just interested enough in now more than just the person of Jesus – but the character of these gospel accounts mm-hmm. that I started to do.
So you were more interested really in the documents as evidence than
yes.
you were of the person who the documents testified about at that particular
right,
point.
Right, because I had this skill set in forensic statement analysis that just made me acutely aware of compression of time, expansion of time, use of tense, use of personal pronouns. These mm-hmm. are the kinds of things that I typically would look for. And those were fascinating to me as I read through. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking for little, you know, how does Paul really feel about James? How does mm-hmm. James really feel about Paul? There's some giveaways here mm-hmm. in terms of the letters back and forth. Mm-hmm. I mean, one seems to be kind of a faith alone position. One seems to be, if you don't carefully read through James 2, is it an opposite position?
Right.
But more than that, how do these two historic characters feel about one another mm-hmm. personally? I think there's some – so I'm always trying to figure these things out mm-hmm. from the body of
you know, I was reading through Mark 15 about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. I'd just been read through Mark, you know, and I got to the end, Mark 15 and crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this stood out for you, but to me this is one of those kinds of things, maybe not like the two puzzle pieces going together, mm-hmm. but – something that you would not expect to see. And so here Jesus is carrying the cross. This is Mark 15, verse 21. I'll just read the verse. You don't okay. have to look it up. It says, after they had mocked him and took a purple robe off him, put his own garments on him, they led him out to crucify him. They pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon the Cyrene, parentheses, the father of Alexander and Rufus, close mm-hmm. parentheses, to bear the cross.
Right.
Now, and maybe you're onto what I'm onto here, but I'm thinking,
yeah, absolutely.
What is that doing in there? Why would anybody put that in there unless the person who is writing about events that other people were aware of, and people in his writing were people that other people reading would know?
Right. No doubt about it. As a matter of fact, I see this a lot, you see it in contrast between the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Mark, that there appear to be places in the Gospel of Mark where Mark is identifying people who are still in the know you could talk to today to confirm the story he's just yeah. offered. So sometimes he'll describe somebody who's got a common name. Simon's a very common name,
mm-hmm.
and so that especially at the time. So you have to identify him as Simon Peter. That makes sense given the time of history because there are so many Simons. But here, he's really being called out to be, why would you bother to do this? You're doing it, I believe, because this is a witness. Now, what's interesting is there are places in Mark where the witness that would be identified would be in some peril early on.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's identified with less detail than John does later when it doesn't matter because uh-huh. he's already passed away.
Uh-huh.
So you see kind of how witnesses are kind
see,
of identified.
I would never have looked for that particular kind of thing. It's something that jumps out.
Well, and then of course you have to kind of argue, you know, is the ending of Mark legitimate? You know, there's lots of arguments on both sides of this. Mm-hmm. How much of the ending of Mark do we want to accept as
the long ending, the so-called long ending of chapter 16.
Ending,
but this
yeah.
is an example
is
where
50, yeah.
you got a little piece that's thrown in there. Oh, by the the way, he's the father of Alexander Rufus. You know, that's the Simon of Cyrene that we're talking about.
Exactly.
Oh, and they're going, yeah, 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 I know who you're talking about now. That's the guy. Yes. Well, he's the guy who carried the cross.
Yes.
I didn't know that. You know, I know Rufus, and I didn't know his dad did that.
And sometimes you'll see, and I've also seen good liars, though, who can do this, too, who will include incidentals, things that are not really critical to the narrative they're trying to convince you of. But they'll include incidentals because typically when we recall an event, it includes things that are important to the narrative and things that aren't that important, mm-hmm. but they just happened and I happened to see them, so I'm going to give them to you. Mm-hmm. And so those incidentals are sometimes a marking of a reliable, true account. But I've also seen situations in which mm-hmm. suspects can mm-hmm. flavor their narrative with incidentals. Here's what's interesting about that. When they flavor it with incidentals and then 15 years go by and they tell you the story again, they still have a desire to flavor it with incidentals mm-hmm. to convince you, but they've forgotten the incidental of the first story. Mm-hmm. So they give you some new incidental. So the main features may be consistent, mm-hmm. but the incidentals contradict, and that's the giveaway. Mm-hmm.
Okay, anyway, when I read Mark 15, that's what I thought. I thought this is one of those particular details, a little insight of what's going on, whatever, and also something that could be cross-referenced by the readers. Mark was the first gospel,
right.
The earliest gospel. So this, of course, this whole story of your own assessment of the text using your tools not only led you to the Lord in the long term, but led to a book in which you talk about that. And I think it's great that as you're coming on board to Stand to Reason, it's the same time you're launching your book. It's called Cold Case Christianity. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I tried just to give 10 some of the principles that over the years that when I found myself teaching a lot because people were interested in how they could apply these tools. And so I was already teaching these in various different presentations. And it turns out I probably identified 20 or so important principles, but mm-hmm. I distilled them down to 10 chapters that just talk about the kind of tools that I keep in my pocket as I begin any investigation or while I'm doing the investigation. So I think that the idea here was to provide a tool set that people could apply, because I've always said that what we do in cold cases is we look at an event in the distant past for which we usually have no living eyewitness. That's why it's cold. We don't have good forensic evidence. That's why it's cold. But we can make the case circumstantially. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing the same kind of thing looking at the events of the first century. Mm-hmm. No living eyewitnesses, no good forensic evidence, but we can make the case circumstantially.
Nobody.
It's a nobody missing, which is the kind of case I'm working right now, which is a nobody murder. Uh-huh. So can I
say what's public about it. You got a conviction on a guy.
We got a conviction on a guy.
From a murder from the 80s, the early 80s.
Yes.
No murder weapon. And no body.
No body. So we don't know how he did it. We don't know where he did it. We don't know what he did with the body. But in spite of all that, we got a conviction on a case that was, you know, very difficult. And right away, the people who were doing the interviews afterwards, you know, for the media, were skeptical and wanted to kind of play up the drama of mm-hmm. this highly circumstantial case. Well, how can you really be certain mm-hmm. that you have the truth here when you don't have a body? And people on both sides, the victim's family, the defendant's family, no one's really happy. No one's really satisfied. No one's really even fully convinced.
The jury
was convinced.
4 hours.
Yes, about 4.5
which
hours.
That's quick.
That's pretty quick, yeah. Especially on a case with no body and it's all circumstantial right. evidence. And that's one of the tools that I really want to help people to assess mm-hmm. is that all these there's very little mm-hmm. that we would consider to be direct evidence. It's typically the eyewitness testimony mm-hmm. Of an eyewitness. That's direct testimony. That's direct evidence. But almost everything else is circumstantial. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I find DNA at a crime scene and a DNA on the body of a victim and the suspect's DNA – that could be powerful. But if he says, well, look, I've been living with her for 2 years, we're together every day, then suddenly the circumstance negates the power of the DNA.
Right.
If he says, I don't know this woman, I've never seen her before, I've never been to her house, and his DNA is there, now the circumstance mm-hmm. makes the evidence powerful. Yeah. So mm-hmm. everything is really circumstantial.
Yeah, it's like, of course my prints are all over the house. I've been visiting for the last 3 years
right.
every day. You know,
right.
You
so, so the circumstance really is what makes it powerful.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, that's why we have to really make a distinction between direct and circumstantial.
So you've got the book, and the book is coming. Is it actually
formally out now?
It's out. It's available. And and before anybody jumps to purchase it on Amazon, just to let you know, in 3 weeks, beginning of February, this is going to be our special offer. So people give a gift to Stand to Reason will get a copy of your book. They give a gift and they make a request for it. Say, I want the book. In virtue of the gift, we'll say thanks by sending a copy of your book. And I can't answer for whether they'll be signed or not, but they might be, because they made me sign a whole bunch of them. We did that with tactics, so I'm sure you'd have to. So that'll be an added bonus, but that's up to Derek and you guys. So anyway, so that's coming out in February. By then, you'll be on full bore with us at STR as a speaker, as a faculty member, as a doing writing for us. Your background, educational background, is in graphic arts and the like, right?
Yeah, design. My background's in design, and I just kind of fell into the family business, more or less. You know, my dad was I remember working in a really great firm in Santa Monica, architectural firm, in grad school, and thinking I don't think I can get much better than this. Mm. But at the same time, it just didn't seem like it fit who I was. I was like a bull in a china shop there. So it was important for me so I came back at 27, and now my son just finished his hiring process and a year of probation. So
four generations now.
Three generations of Jim Wallace's. So if you were to call the police department.
You said your grandfather.
No, but he was not a cop. He was a craftsman, more or less. And kind of like an architect of his day. You know, he was a builder. But I can tell you this. Something kind of fun is going to happen on Thursday. I actually, it's my last day of work there. So on my last day, I'm going to put on a uniform, which I haven't put on in a while. It's more of a ride-along than anything else. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to get in the car with my son, and we're going to work a shift. My last shift will be working patrol.
This is the kind of thing they make movies out of. You're going to get shot, and that's going to be the J. Warner Wallace, you know.
Well, my son would love something really fantastic to happen during this shift. But it's an opportunity for us to kind of do something that I'll
that's
remember
really
forever.
Great. I'm sure he will. So that's super. Look at J. Warner, great to have you on board for a few minutes here today.
So glad to be
I'm
here.
I'm so thrilled that you are
I'm the lucky
part of
one.
Our team.
Before I leave, Greg, let me just say I'm going to steal some of your time for the break here. But you know that I met you first through Brett because I was working with Brett.
Mm-hmm. Brett Kunkel.
Brett Kunkel doing some youth ministry stuff, and I got a chance to meet you. But I've been listening to your stuff for a long time. As a matter of fact, back when you were doing Tactics, just starting, I guess, doing Tactics, and I bought the cassette tape version.
Way back in the late Pleistocene period.
Yes, and it really was really powerful for me because it was so resonated with the stuff I was doing in interviews. I mean, that really, when I got saved, the very first apologetics resource that I turned to was you.
Wow.
So this is why it's kind of like I get to come home by coming back to Stand to Reason. So I'm really glad to be here.
Well, it's a perfect relationship, so we're really thrilled to have you.
Well, I'm the lucky one. So.
Okay. J. Warner Wallace coming on board very shortly. And, of course, you'll hear him behind this mic when I'm out of town, too. That'll be part of his job description. So let's go to break and then come back to your calls, 1-800-227-5278 for Stand to Reason.
Want to know what's going on with STR? Speaking events, new resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Post comments and interact with STR staff and other like-minded Christians. You can find all our social media connections at str.org.
Is God just a crutch? Was Jesus a fraud? Are science and faith antithetical? Christian apologist and philosopher Greg Kunkel applies his trademark clear thinking to these and other vexing issues facing believers today in Faith Is Not Wishing, 13 Essays for Christian Ambassadors. Through this thoughtful approach, Greg demonstrates that Christian faith is not wishful thinking, but rather a sure conviction grounded in evidence. Visit Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org to get a copy of Faith Is Not Wishing, or call 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800-2-REASON.
I'd like to extend to you an invitation to join with some others who are making a significant difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. And there is a special group of strategic partners who become the solid foundation of STR's ability to work effectively. Strategic partners are just what the name implies, people who've committed their regular financial support for Stand to Reason so that we can plan effectively to take advantage of opportunities for training and equipping. Now, they accomplish this by pledging to make a gift to Stand to Reason each month. If you'd like to become a part of this important group, just call 1-800-2-REASON today for more information. And we've selected some gifts of appreciation for those who stand with STR monthly as a strategic partner, and we'd like to give them to you. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about, both in the world and in the church, consider becoming a strategic partner today. Training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their faith and values. So call STR at 1-800-2-REASON to find out how you can sign up to become a strategic partner.
Back with
to hear Stand to Reason. Ready to take your calls at 1-800-227-5278. Let's go to Gary in Oklahoma. Let me get the button here. Gary, glad you called. Hi.
Hey, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing good. Having a lot of fun here on the first show of the new year.
That's right. I'm a little winded. That's because I'm in the middle of a workout and I just stopped, okay? But I can get the question, I believe.
Are you at your home or at a gym?
Oh, I'm at home.
All right.
Let me ask you the question.
Okay.
For about five or six years, I've known a guy that I used to work with. We're now Facebook friends. And this guy's an atheist. And about every year or so, maybe twice a year, we get into a debate about the existence of God.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, Facebook is a terrible place to do that, but that's our means of communication. And I've been praying for this guy forever. Well, in the past, what has always happened is he will ask me for evidence. First, he'll compare our faith to Bigfoot, of course. It's pretty standard atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And then he will ask for evidence. I will give him evidence, and he'll get very upset, start name-calling, start belittling me, just dissembling, basically going all over the board, okay? Mm-hmm. And so I determined this time we weren't going to do that. And he said, you know, I'd be happy to look at any of your evidence if it's based on reason if it's based on good reason. And I said, okay, and I described the genetic code to him, the genome.
Mm-hmm.
And I simply said, Mike, did the genome, where did it come from? Did it come from an intelligent source or not?
Mm-hmm.
And he just went, you know, he just started saying, hey, thousands of scientists believe, you know, agree with me, blah, 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 you know, all this stuff. So, I brought up a recent quote by Ben Carson who said that it was, you know, the key, most damning piece of evidence to evolution, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's my problem. Throughout this very long thread, I have not responded emotionally to Mike at all.
Uh-huh.
Mike's been, you know, he's been hurling the zingers at me, and I've typed out, you know, I could just blast a guy if I wanted to. His reasoning is really bad, but I have not done it. All I've done is come back and said, you know, do you believe it's from intelligence or not? You know, what's your explanation? That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's fine, but the problem is I feel like I'm getting very, very angry inside.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this so often with atheists that they make personally cutting, insulting, belittling remarks.
Mm-hmm.
And so this time I said, you know, I'm not going to give him ammunition. I'm going to come back and simply stick to reason and science. And I've done that, but Greg, I'm pretty angry inside at all of the ad hominem attacks made that are completely baseless.
Uh-huh.
And so I want to know, I know you have faced this, and I know that apologists face this constantly. How do you deal with the fact that you want to blast them back, and it would be very, very easy to
I have a couple of thoughts on this, and I'm chuckling a little bit because I went – earlier last year, I was in Hungary doing some work at a conference there, and William Lane Craig was also there, and he was talking about debate style, and someone raised this very question. And the question was, how do you deal with people that are being so mean? You know, because I try to, the fellow said, I try to get in debates and stuff with people, and then I just get so much abuse heaped upon me. What do you do? And here's what Bill Craig said. As he said, rejoice. Think of Jesus' comments in the Sermon on the Mount. I'm looking at the exact. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you falsely, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad. So, I mean, I don't want to miss saying this. I got more to say besides this, but I don't want to miss saying the great advice that Bill Craig gave, which was just to recite the advice of Jesus himself. And this is something I'm glad you brought it up because it's good for all of our audience
to hear. I have a chapter in the book on tactics called Steamroller, and so I talk about how to deal with these kinds of people, and there are practical steps to be taken, but I do not want to miss the direct admonition of the Lord regarding these things, which is to rejoice. Because the spirit of grace and glory rests upon us, Peter writes in 1 Peter chapter 4, when we are persecuted for Christ's name. So that's the first thing. I mean, this is reason to alter or adjust your frame of reference and say, hey, praise the Lord. All right. I know it's not always easy. I understand when the angry feelings come up. I feel them myself. And over time, I have learned to manage those better. And one thing that makes it easier for me to manage it on the air is that I know that thousands of people are listening to me.
Right.
So if I make a fool out of myself, I'm doing it in front of lots of people. So that is a great incentive. And by the same token, you've got people that on your Facebook that are abusing you, and you're responding not in kind, but by contrast, you are giving arguments and gracious responses. People are watching that. And if you remind yourself of that, as well as reminding yourself of what Jesus said in Matthew 5, but you remind yourself that, look, people are watching, and a lot of people can see this guy's being a jerk and I'm not, that will be an encouragement as well. I do think that there is a place, though, for calling him out on his abuse.
I'm so glad you're bringing this up, because I feel like sometimes, as Christians, what I'm supposed to do is never basically call him out on his awful behavior.
No.
But really, on his terrible arguments.
Yeah. Well, you think of Jesus at his trial. When Jesus was at his trial, and this goes, you know, there's some applications here for the turn the other cheek business we read about there, and also in Matthew 5, what Jesus might have had in mind here. Because at Jesus' trial, he was struck, and somebody slapped him, and he did not turn the other cheek. Instead, he said this: if I did something wrong, bear witness to the wrong. If I did nothing wrong, then why did you slap me?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's straightforward, tough stuff. I mean, I love that when I read that, because there's my Savior, not the Jesus meek and mild with two fingers in the air, you know, trembling, but rather the tough carpenter saying, all right, I can take it, but I'm not going to let you get away with it. If I did something wrong, say what I did wrong. If I didn't do something wrong, then why did you slap me? And so he calls, Jesus calls that person out there in the Sanhedrin. And by the same token, I think that you can call a person out who's being abusive to you. You have to do it the right way.
Yeah.
And I think it's okay
to
do
it. That's the key.
Okay.
Well, the other thing you've told me in the past, Greg, that has been really helpful is, you know, you don't have to think that you must win the argument right this minute.
That's right.
If you have actually caused him to recognize that you have solid evidence and he knows that he's dissembling, then you let it rest and come back to him later, because there will be a later.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But if I know that if I blow him away, then we won't speak again for a long, long time, and I may have damaged the relationship. So
right, but you don't have to blow him away. You don't have to get out the heavy artillery and let him have it. You can just...
Right.
And here I'm going to use my words very carefully. You can, as an adult, demand of another adult adult behavior. Okay?
Good.
So as an adult, you're going to demand of another adult adult behavior. And it's very simple to do in a certain sense. And a version of this is in the book under the tactics chapter. And you say, and what you do is say, this is how we're going to have a discussion. Since you are committed to the notion of reason, the only thing I'm going to respond to are reasonable challenges and reasonable remarks. Whenever you offer something that's snide, abusive, and impolite, I am not going to respond to that, but I will call you out. Ridicule is not an argument. Ridicule is not an argument. If you want to have a reasonable discussion about this, I'm your man. But I'm not going to let you get away with informal fallacies like personal attacks, etc., etc.
Right.
And so
right.
when he comes back and he says blah, 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 you say, okay, here's the point you made. You said this, that was a personal attack, and that's not right. And this was a thing, and that's I'm not going to go for that, and this is blah, blah, blah. So you call him out. You don't have to do it in a mean way. Go back to the chapter, I don't know which gospel it is, but there at the trial, and just think about the way Jesus responded. If I did wrong, bear witness to the wrong. If I did no wrong, why did you slap me? Why are you calling me names when I have given you an argument? I've given you a piece of evidence. Are you capable of dealing with the evidence without calling me a name? If you are, then do that. If you are not, I don't want to have this discussion. Why can't you write something like that?
But you can.
Yeah, you can. See, and it goes up on the page, and then everybody can see it. Now, what's he going to say?
Yeah. No, that's good. The problem I have is that when I read what he writes, my impulse is to respond immediately, and when I respond immediately, it is in the heat of anger.
Yeah, well, you don't have
to. And I can't do that.
You can write it down immediately, but then just give yourself 10 minutes or a half an hour or whatever it takes to go back and read what you have written and say, is this the right way to put it? Now, you could be, by the way, you could be entirely fuming about your treatment to him and still say, if I did something wrong, bear witness to the wrong. And if not, then why did you slap me? You can offer something like that even though you're angry. That's not an inappropriate response. That's appropriate. Why are you calling names?
Right.
Do you want me to answer your issue? Do you have something substantive to say? If you have something substantive to say, then you shouldn't be doing the A, B, C, or D. So you tell me what it's going to be. If you want me to respond, you get back to me with a rational response. These are the guys of reason, right? These are the guys who think they got reason on their side.
Right.
They got it all squared away.
Right.
You give me a rational response, and I will answer it. Don't answer with a bunch of nonsense. I will. If you answer with any of this stuff, I'm taking it off. I'm just going to delete it from the Facebook, and I will keep deleting it until I get something reasonable and rational that's not abusive. Can you play by those rules? You can say to him, can you play by those rules? And by the way, I have said something like this on my own website because I've had trollers who come to my website and want to beat up on me and my friends in my living room, when I didn't invite them in to have this kind of discussion. And so I've mentioned this a few times, and most of the people play by the rules, and sometimes people get out of hand and they just go bye-bye. And sometimes they get blocked. No, you don't want to block your friend because you want to stay in relationship with him. But you can be in charge here.
Yeah.
Fair enough?
Okay. Fair enough. Thanks a bunch.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
I appreciate the call. Look it. This is the key to the steamroller approach. And by the way, the lines are virtually open. 1-800-227-5272. We got more? Okay. 1-800-227-5278. I'm not sure why you're shaking your head, but... we'll get to the callers here in just a moment. But you are in charge of your side of the conversation, friends. You do not have to allow yourself to be dragged around by the nose, beat up, ridiculed, or any of that stuff. You don't have to respond in kind. Why can't you just say ridicule is not an argument? Abuse is not an argument. Laughter is not an argument. Name-calling is not an argument. And it's not polite. So what's it going to be? You want to have a polite conversation about things that really matter, or do you want to be abusive? If you want to be abusive, I'm not going to talk to you. No audience, no performance. If you want to talk about something reasonable, you want to offer your rational arguments that you atheists claim to be filled with, the thick with, then go ahead and may the best argument win. But no more abuse. You don't have to put up with it. Okay? Let's see. Let's go to Jason in Delaware. Jason, welcome to the show. That's Delaware, Ohio, not the state of Delaware.
Oh, my brother, I was promoting your wonderful blessing teaching on the Catholic apologetics the other day. That got kind of hot. I said, listen to the Protestant uncle in Central Ohio. And it was quite wonderful. But okay. I love my Catholic brothers. We are allies in the culture war. But although I disagree on many points.
Yeah, well, that's a nice way to put it. Right.
Yeah, I would like to – I've been getting some skeptics coming to me with this Lilith character. And not to boast, but – by God's grace and mercy, I fell in love with the Bible, and I love apologetics. I got saved at 19. I was heavily into alcohol, and so I've been immediately, a lot of my friends were not born, they weren't Christian, and a lot of my family were not Christian. I was not raised in church, so I've been very much clinging to apologetics all my Christian life. And so my question is, this Lilith character, I've never found her in any of the translations or paraphrases I've read through. I've read through eight. I found a small comment about something about vampires in the apologetics, Rabbi Zacharias book. I'm sure you probably contributed some of the articles. But who is Lilith? And I can take my answer.
Well, you know what? No, that's okay. Well, Jason, stay with me for a second here, because I don't know who Lilith is. And what Melinda has written up, did Adam have another wife? So I don't follow the vampire genre at all, and I actually haven't written anything with Ravi. I'd be glad to, but I haven't, as it turns out. But I don't follow all of that stuff. I don't get into that. I'm a little mystified by the fascination the culture seems to have for that kind of stuff right now. But we have the biblical record of Adam, and then we have folklore. All right, apparently. As Melinda just posted here for me, there's some Jewish folklore about a character, Lilith.
Yeah.
This is like a lot of other things that people come up with. It's the same question we should ask them that they've been asking us. What reason does someone have to believe that this is sound, that this event happened, that this detail of some ancient story actually took place? What is the evidence for it? We have an accounting with regards to Adam in the Bible. If there is some other folklore that deals with this particular individual, then the question is, what reason do we have to take that folklore or that writing seriously as historically sound or reliable?
Right.
That would be the question. Yeah, well, yeah, and so the question that I have of them, if they've offered these alternatives, is why should I believe any of these alternatives?
Right. They were trying the two skeptics I was talking with, one of them was a Christian brother. I was very kind of shocked. He was bringing up Cain's wife and saying, well, maybe, you know, Adam had some children with this Lilith character. And so I just don't have any
reason to believe that. That would be the simplest way of putting it. I have no reason to believe it. These records that we have from the book of Genesis go way back. They're very ancient records. This Lilith character apparently appears in the 8th or 10th century. Is that the Common Era, you mean, a B.C. or A.D.? A.D.? In any event, so, you know, why? It sounds like your skeptic friend is not skeptical enough. At least of this Lilith stuff. Okay, I got to go to break here. And I think, thank you so much for your call, Jason. And coming back with more calls after this on Stand to Reason.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused?
STR.org is a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for. Before you turn to Google, log on to STR.org, and you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse the range of topics. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our blog, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from STR.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ and the tactics that will help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. Your visit to STR.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you take a stand for the truth. So visit today. That's STR.org.
Final segment here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind here with you every Sunday, by the way, from 2 until 5. Those are our live times in Los Angeles. If you want to call in the future, make your adjustment if you're a podcast listener. By the way, our homework for this week featured article is called 10-Minute Witness. It's actually an example of how I was able to take a 10-minute encounter with a door-to-door salesman and use it as an opportunity to say something meaningful about Christ. And this will only take you 10 minutes to read it. So I commend that to you. 10-Minute Witness at STR.org. Let's go to Michigan. And whoops, wait a minute. That says line one. Which line is Craig from Michigan on? Two? Okay, let me do that. Okay, is this Craig?
Yes.
Craig, welcome to the show. Greg Kokel,
well,
hi.
Thanks, Greg. Thank you. Yeah, I'm a longtime listener, and your ministry has really helped me immensely in my walk and in my witness for other people. So
good.
Really glad to be calling in and talking to you.
Glad to have you on board.
Thank you. But my question is, I'll give you some background first. I'm a substance abuse counselor.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, I work with parolees who have substance abuse problems. And
you work with what or who that has? I missed that word.
Parolees.
Oh, parolees. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Got it.
And fortunately, you know, many of the guys that I get to talk to, a lot of them, you know, have found Christ either in prison or jail or whatever have you. So, you know, they've kind of got a good foundation for me to start talking with them about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I work for, the organization I work for isn't faith-based or anything. The programs that we use are faith-based. But, of course, you know, I kind of have some common ground with
but
them.
But you are faith-based, so, yeah.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yes, I am. So anyhow, I just had a question about sin and how that relates to substance abuse. I may be wrong about this, but from all I can really get out of the scripture, when it talks about drinking at least, it seems like drinking can be more sinful just because it can lead to some sinful behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if there's any sort of inherent sin in just, like, ingesting a substance for the purpose of, you know, getting high.
Well, yeah, this is an interesting question because there weren't laws back then in Bible times like they have now regarding substance abuse. And so you don't have prescription medicine and that kind of thing where you have laws that govern how you use these things. Nowadays, we could say, well, look, these things are illegal, and we're supposed to obey the law. So this then becomes a way of helping us make moral decisions about these things because the law is in play. But what about when there was no law or there is no law, what's the view then? And the closest we have, I mean, what if it turned out that heroin and marijuana and cocaine and a whole bunch of other things, what if if the law never addressed those things, would it be immoral for us as Christians to use those things? And I haven't actually given this a lot of thought except for the idea that I think the alcohol example in the Bible is helpful. And here we have
you read in the Old Testament and in the New Testament different references for it. In fact, I just recently read the book of Proverbs. There's about six or seven verses that talk about the problems with alcohol. They're all tucked in there together, and then how you get drunk and you get in fights and you get wounded and then you get sick, and then it's like laying down on the top of a mast, and then you say, oh, I'll have another drink, you know. And you get a picture of that. And then in Paul, in the book of Ephesians, says that we should not be drunk with wine, for that is dissipation, but we should be filled with the Spirit. And so I think from those two kind of passages, we can draw some conclusions. The first thing is I don't think, take alcohol, for example, that the Scripture is against drinking alcohol or using alcohol. Jesus used alcohol, so it can't be a sin. However, there is a line. There are liabilities to it. And the liability, and so this is where I think there's parallels with substance abuse. By the way, incidentally, notice how the term that you used yourself, it's called substance abuse.
Yeah.
When you're taking a substance and abusing it in the way that it ends up causing problems, that's, I think, when biblically speaking, you're crossing the line. So on the one hand, you have the worries or the problems of alcohol, and I don't have the proverb in front of me where I had read that, but you're probably familiar with it. So look at these things, that there are inherent difficulties that you have to be aware of, that abuse of this thing can lead you into. And what that might mean for some people is that you don't even touch it, even any use is abuse, because you can't avoid the extremes. Yes, that's right. And then if you, it's not just the physical problems, but if it's taking control of you, if you're getting wasted, for that is dissipation, that's wasted, you know, if you're getting wasted on it, then these are also evidences that, that these things shouldn't be used. So, I think that there are some things like alcohol, people can use in moderation. Some people can use, maybe most people can use in moderation without creating a difficulty. There are other substances that even apart from the issue of what's legal and illegal, it doesn't appear that you can use them in moderation. You take meth, you take crack, you snort cocaine. These are the kinds of things that by their nature lead to abusive habits, destructive habits, which is why they're illegal. So the fact that they're illegal seems to map over the moral issue. They're illegal for a reason. They're dangerous and they're damaging. And if they're dangerous and damaging in their use to yourself and others, then that brings in the moral consideration as well.
Yeah. And I can see that. And, you know, obviously in the case of meth, heroin, and crack, things like that, it's pretty obvious how the use leads to all kinds of negative behavior and that sort of thing. So if with those guys, it's usually not too tough to help them see how their substance abuse is a problem. But the ones where it really gets more sticky for me is someone who, say, is taking just a little bit too much of their prescription painkillers or, you know, drinking, and their wife doesn't like how much they drink, but they're not driving, they're not breaking the law, that sort of thing. Now, in their case, you know, if they happen to be on parole, then even if they're not breaking the law necessarily, they could be violating their parole.
Yes, and that's a different consideration. So then it's not the alcohol itself that's the problem. It's the vulnerability to parole violation, which has other ramifications for their personal life and their family's life, etc. So that would weigh in on the decision. When it comes to the wife issue, this one's a little bit trickier, because it somewhat depends on what the let me back up and put it this way. If a guy is doing something that his wife doesn't like, it's stupid for him not to pay attention to that. All right? It's just plain stupid. And all other moral questions aside, there's a wisdom issue here. But there also is an issue of being, when you're married, you are in a committed relationship with another person. And it's not just that you're committed, it's the kind of commitment you're making. The two become one. It ought to make a difference to a husband what his wife is sensitive to in his life. It ought to make a difference. Now, it doesn't mean that everything the wife says, the husband's got to do. Sometimes there's inordinate sensibilities and that kind of stuff. But it might be a good question to ask, why does the wife think the husband drinks too much? One of the answers is maybe he does. She can see it, he can't. And so a wise man will draw from the counsel and wisdom of and the counsel of those closest to him. And that's just smart, it seems to me. And it may be they're really onto something. The wife may be onto something that he is doing something that's really dangerous. So minimally, just to maintain marital harmony, which is important and which I think we have a moral obligation to attend to, that husband ought to listen to his wife. So there's a little tool in your arsenal.
Sure.
Morality aside, don't be stupid. You know, when mom's unhappy, everybody's unhappy. You know, you've heard that one before.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Secondly, maybe mom's onto something. Maybe wife's onto something. And this is another thing we should be taking counsel from those who know us best. Okay. So when it comes to prescription medication, this is somewhat of a judgment call. I have prescription medication that relates to pain because I have some chronic situations. And, I guess I'm not tempted to abuse that. I have some sleeping medication that I take, though, and sometimes I feel like I'd like to take that every night so I can get a good night's sleep, but I'm trying to be careful with that so I don't abuse it. So I have balance in my own life on that, but I can see how people might be tempted to abuse. And in those circumstances, it's only those that are close to the circumstances that can give the best counsel. It's best to err on the side of safety, I would say, but that's a wisdom concern. I don't know that there's any hard and fast rule. You are probably in a better position than most to be counseled to your parolees because you can see their lives a little bit more. And the wife as well. So when it comes to prescription medication, sometimes if you've got dangerous stuff, you just got to be really careful with it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you've definitely given me some new things to think about and some new things in my arsenal for this week. So,
yeah. Well,
I really appreciate it.
Well, you got a tough job, Craig, I think it's tough partly because the questions that you're addressing, the issues you're addressing, are to some degree answered by an appeal to wisdom and self-control. And wisdom and self-control are the kinds of things that are often in short supply with the people that you have to deal with on a regular basis. And so that makes your job more tricky.
Yeah, I wish you could come with me to work
on it. Craig, it's not my gift. But I'm glad, God bless you, Craig, and I'm glad that you're doing it. So keep up the good work, and I hope that what I've offered will help some. That's all. That's it for today, friends. Thank you for listening. Don't forget a 10-minute witness. That's our featured article on Stand to Reason and at STR.org. And I will be back next week for more fun like this, all right? See you then. In the meantime, you go out and give them heaven. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.